Welcome back to Ladies with Gumption. We recap DCTV in a flash. Welcome back because it's been a two-week hiatus and we're happy to be back. And I know that we've missed you. You've missed us. We've gotten a lot of asks and stuff. So we really, really appreciate it. This episode is episode 51, Feels Good to Be Bad. I am your introductress, May, and I am here with...
That's not a
Tatiana.
It's not a word, but we made it one anyway.
It's a very important job.
It is.
Yeah.
I'm still Tatiana.
Yeah.
We're so
you know
we don't know how to do it anymore.
I know, it feels like it's been so long, but it's only been 2 weeks, okay? Getting back into the groove. You can find us on iTunes, Google Play, at Podomatic. You can send us your asks or thoughts by email at ladieswgumption@gmail.com, by Twitter at DCTVGumption, or on Tumblr at ladieswgumption.tumblr.com. This week, we had a lot of feedback, tons of asks from regarding a bunch of different things. So a lot of people were mainly concerned with Jessica Parker Kennedy's ET interview regarding Nora's storyline and her tension with her mom.
Well, like all of the interviews, any interview that comes out from Jessica or from Candace spins people off into a spiral.
Yes. Even though the con that Hartley and Candace attended at New Jersey was pretty good, I'd say. And then they dropped a couple of hints here and there. And then Grant Gustin dropped hints about Cicada. So is there anything that you guys want to add on?
About new things that we've heard?
Yeah, or just...
Well, there was those filming pictures of Ragdoll from, like, the event that presumably Barry and Iris went to. And there's, like, the Flash helping people out. So that was pretty cool.
I don't know if they were intentionally trying to make him look like Jigsaw or not, but he does. Like, the mask and, like...
Yeah.
Like, why are you giving this black man this, like, weird, like, red hair? I mean, I get, like, Ragdoll in the comics have, like, the red hair and all that kind of stuff. Like, he just looks like Jigsaw to me. So, I don't know. But I hope his powers are cool and that, you know...
Yeah, I'm ready to see the contortioning.
Yeah.
Do
we have words of comfort or rage regarding all the spiraling of interviews and people concerned about what Iris may or may not be doing this season?
I mean,
I'm just tired. I'm like tired of like just like stop asking Candace and Jessica questions until the season starts. So I don't have to like hear about tension. It's like a curse word now. Like I don't want to hear the word tension ever again.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that it's just, I don't know, for me, like, I feel like it's just stressing everyone out, including us, but at the same time, it's just kind of repeat answers from Comic-Con.
Yes.
So it's not really anything new that we've learned, so we don't really know how long this tension will last. I still think it's going to end by the second
or third episode.
It feels
like it's taking longer just because it's been longer and they're not getting new answers, but they're not going to give new answers until we've seen the results of the first ones.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. Like, they may not be, like, Nora and Iris may not be in the same place relationship-wise in the beginning of the season as what they're filming now, but they can't really talk about what they're filming now in that relationship because we haven't seen the first couple episodes, and so... Anything that has to do with their relationship in, like, episode 7 may be because of something that they resolve in episode 2. And since we haven't seen episode 2 and don't know what episode 2 is about, then they can't really talk about that.
Right.
So. And I think people forget the fact that there was also mention of tension between her and her dad. Because people, I guess, gloss over it, but they're also going to butt heads. So it's not all hunky-dory in Nora Berryland.
Right. Yeah, I think it's more just, like, because of the comparison, like, we know she's going to have a lot of scenes with Barry and then only some scenes with Iris, so it feels like, you know, out of what, and then, of course, Candace downplaying the journalism, and we don't know Hartley from Adam to trust him or not, but there's going to be more than Candace said. But I will point out that, like, oftentimes, like, Candace will downplay something, and then Grant will contradict and say, no, that's not true, there's more. So, I don't know, that's sort of how I see it, like, I'm not saying don't advocate or don't be angry or don't whatever to the writers. Because, yeah, sure, tell them that what we want to see and that we want to make sure Iris has a storyline and gets to do journalism, et cetera. They've been listening to us for 5 years. whether or not they do what we say, but they haven't blocked all of us yet. So keep going if you want. But I don't think that you have to despair, you know, like,
right.
Either way, the show is going to come back in a month and you're going to know, you know?
Right.
I also think that Candace can be very, like, literal. So, like, says no, journalism-ish, or there's no journalism. There's no, like, she's not going back to CCP and getting her job back every day, going to work, writing out articles that appear in a newspaper, you know, saying, I'm going to formulate a city citizen. Like, that's not happening yet. And so it's kind of, like, the ish. And I think the ish part is what Hartley picked up on, is the fact that, yeah, she's doing a lot, because she's going to be more investigative than reporter, is what I think.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I think they're more concerned.
We know she's doing something every episode.
Yeah.
Right. And we know she's doing something specifically with Ralph, too. So more investigative, which isn't technically journalism, because she's not, like, writing it and publishing it in a paper, but she is doing, like, the investigative work.
Right, and I think the whole point is, like, to build towards Central City Citizen, and that's why it's not like she's going to be at work every day. And I also think, like, on a positive note, that literally the Flash is terrible at drawing out tension. They'll literally last for 2 or 3 episodes, and then it will disappear as if nothing happened, as we've seen multiple times since season 1.
Yeah.
So if that makes you feel better, I hope it makes you feel better, but I guess we won't really know until the season starts, but
also finally, recency bias, just because there is literally an episode called Newsflash, and we know that there's that other, like, vlogger, social media reporter girl in that episode. So, like, unless they're, like, the dumbest people ever, which is possible, this is in the realm of possibility, but unless that is true, that episode will have Irish journalism. Like, it would be insane otherwise.
Yeah, and I think that, like, in general, Candace still seems excited about the season, and Grant's super excited about the season, so I feel like I'm still excited about the season, but I'm not thinking about it. So there you go. We got some more feedback by email from Shang, who has many, many feelings about Supergirl, specifically. So for the Golden Child, she just basically mentions that she did enjoy.
So she gave some thoughts on all the shows, and then she went into detail on Supergirl.
Exactly. So for the Flash,
we're assuming Shang is a female, but
yes, I'm sorry if you are not. Please let me know. This is just my assumption, and I apologize if I am wrong. So Shang, I'm just going to use your name. Did enjoy season 4 for the most part, even though the pacing was a little bit choppy. Shang is not into Ralph as much. Obviously, he's quite a jerk, as we all can agree on this at the beginning and in the end, and hopefully that changes in season 5. Let's see. Most excited about Nora in season 5, and also a Tornado Twins arc, because that was part of the enjoyment of Young Justice and the comics that they read. So that's exciting. And then hoping Iris' journalism arc will be a focal point, which we all agree on. For the Brooding Child, Arrow, Shang likes the dragon as a villain, so that's interesting because we all did not. Shang says it's so much of a jerk, I hope he dies.
Yes.
But the excitement is really for the Longbow Hunters, and that they're dope in the comics, and that they hope the writers do them justice, which we all hope that they do. Let's see.
Yes.
And no more NTA, OTA nonsense, which we can all agree on.
Definitely agree.
For Black Lightning, looking forward to Jennifer's new superhero costume, as well as thinking that the first season could have used a few more episodes to wrap some things up, but overall it was strong. And most excited for The Outsiders, if they pop up this season. Let's see. Favorite Wild Child, Legends of Tomorrow. They've gotten better since season 1, and that happy that they've become more of like a comedic group rather than the darkness of season 1, which didn't fit their tone. And Shang likes that they don't subscribe to the usual superhero packaging, which is nice. So, going into Supergirl, lots of points. Guardian Corps versus Super Corps. Didn't like Guardian Corps at first, but they grew on Shang, so now they enjoy it. It's nice. James and Lena have, you know, good rapport now, especially in the back half of season 3. and hopes that they have cute lunches at Catco and that they're drama free. But there's a lot of super core stuff going on here, and we're going to gloss over some of it and hope we come back to it for a ship episode that we're going to talk about in the future. But that basically there's a lot of parallels between Supergore and West Allen, and that's why
I have made several gift sets based on those parallels.
And that's why Shang thinks there's a little bit of queer baiting there, and why she can understand why people think that. So for, let's see, hopes for Kara that she has a storyline outside of a white undeserving man, which yes, absolutely, because Kara's totally been sidelined, and that she hopes the consequences of Kara's actions are dealt with, because like the time travel thing that was never mentioned, and Barry gets shit on even though no one else does. For Alex, that she gets to be director of DEO, possibly have a girlfriend, and potentially become a mother. And for Lena, let her go through public speech without everyone being in danger. Oh, she definitely hopes that she'll get to learn Kara's secret identity, which will ease... Well, maybe it could make some more tension. I'm not sure. But it could be more interesting, I think.
It would relieve tension from me. That's another thing that I cannot say at that moment. Like, just tell Lena. Like, let her find out. Tell Lena something needs to happen. I'm tired of, like, the, like, I initially liked Lena being in the gray area of will she go bad or won't she go bad, but it's now season four. It's gotten to IR season one levels where everyone is just, like, blatantly, like, lying to this woman that's a smart woman.
There's no reason to lie.
Yeah. So just, like, let her, if she's going to go bad because of this, let's do it. Like, let's go. I want to see Bad Lena come out to play. Like, just let the fallout happen and go from there. It doesn't mean, like, she has to be, like, 100% evil and never come back. You know, there could always be new tension between their, like, new relationship, but I just want to see it. Like, I'm tired of, like, this let's all lie to Lena and pretend like she's an idiot kind of thing.
Right. Exactly. Like, I don't want, like, I'm with our person whose name I've forgotten, Shang. Even though I love you deeply, Shang. I'm with Shang. I love you very much, Shang. In that I don't want to see Lena turn evil, but I also don't want to see Lena have to be, like, maintain her goodness, like, proving her goodness repeatedly while everyone is lying to her and treating her like an idiot, you know? Because at some point, I'm just like, just,
that
you just know.
Makes you go bad because, you exactly. know, friends mm-hmm. that you thought were your friends, you know, treated you like an idiot.
Exactly.
I agree with all of this.
But thanks for your email, Shang.
Yes. I mean, there's a lot more, but basically she hopes everyone gets their due next season and that the villain is very strong. So we can all agree on that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you so, so much for your email. We always love to hear your thoughts, no matter how long they are, so please don't be deterred.
Send us your essays.
Yes, send us all your essays. We enjoy reading them. As for casting news, Elizabeth Bitsy Tulloch is cast as Lois Lane for the Arrowverse crossover, so that's exciting. I personally haven't seen her in many things, if at all, but I think that she seems very passionate about Lois, and that she, from what I've heard, that other people have enjoyed her on, was it Grimm?
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Grimm.
Well, like, some of our listeners are like,
Yeah, not they, everyone's I happy.
Yeah, so, you know, it's kind of a mixed bag, and I never watched Grimm. I think I watched, like, the pilot, and that was it. So I can't really say much about how good she'll be or not. It seems like from her Instagram post, she at least did her research on Lois Lane. And so she's got, you know, passion, gumption, if you will, in that sense. But as far as if she has acting skills, the jury's still out.
I guess we'll have to see.
I've heard from a couple of friends that she was really good on Grimm. And, of course, the fact that she was hated on Grimm as playing the Iris or the Laurel role makes her perfect for Lois, I guess. But yeah, obviously there are some people that are not that thrilled about it. And right now it's kind of, you know, I think she looks the part and she is the correct age. Mm-hmm. And that's all I can ask for. So I'm ready to...
Yes, they actually hired a woman in her 30s. It's very exciting.
Yeah. And not even early 30s.
I know. And so hopefully she'll have, like, a ton of chemistry with Tyler, so that would be exciting.
Hopefully. Hopefully.
Yes, hopefully. Yeah. Next up is Breck Basinger, who has been cast to play DC Universe's Stargirl. And I don't know of her, and I don't know if you guys know of her, but it's just another...
No,
I just... I know she was in some show called Bella and the Bulldogs, that's all I got. I didn't watch that show, but two of our Flash writers wrote for that show, so.
Okay.
They may have even created that show, so it's a small world after all.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It's a Nickelodeon show. Oh, yeah, so the Nickelodeon writers.
The Nickelodeon writers, yes.
So that'll be interesting. Oh, it's the Ralph writers, okay.
The Ralph Riders. Anyway.
Okay, and in some Arrowverse crossover news, Jeremy Davies has been cast to play John Deegan, who is a doctor at Arkham Asylum, who's apparently crazier than his patients, and he'll be the reason the rest of the superheroes are drawn to Gotham City. So, go ahead.
Glad we're going to Gotham. I'm glad that we finally got that confirmed, because I feel like it was not clear before.
Yeah.
So.
It's like, are we on Supergirl's Earth? Is she coming there? Are they going to go to Gotham? What's happening? So that's good. Then we have Catherine McNamara, who is from Shadowhunters, and she'll be in a recurring role during the first half of Arrow season 7 as Maya, a scrappy street fighter and thief from Star City. And the initial casting notice, or unofficial as well, for the character compared her to Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Interesting.
Yeah. And when we saw this, like, when the casting notices first came out, was this the one that we were like, maybe this is, no, which, what was the notice for the half-Japanese character? Do y'all remember?
It was, no, I don't remember. I don't think it was this one, though. I think this one was a little after that one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I remember it being like, but like Street Fighter and Thief is kind of similar, but I think it said it was more like she's like a martial artist, but also something else. Okay. I don't remember what the other thing was, but it wasn't a thief, so.
I'm just trying to figure out where she fits in or why, or if, like, she's potentially going to be in the Batwoman series, and she's kind of like the tie-in, because, like, they're supposed to be building it up through Arrow.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. That's possible.
So who is she in the Gotham? Well, I mean, I guess Maya is her original character, because I don't even recognize that as anybody from the
comic. Right. I mean, like, yeah, there isn't really, like, a clear connection going on at the moment.
Kate's Robin of sorts.
Right, right. I guess, you know, like, it does kind of sound like a Robin. Like, it sounds a little bit like, I've already forgotten her name, the person that the Queen was supposed to be.
Mia,
yes. So it sounds like a little bit like Mia. And that's the kind of vibe that I get from it. But since Oliver already has enough sidekicks running around, it doesn't really make sense for her to be a new one.
Right. So.
Yeah, and they don't seem to have cast his half-sister yet.
Right. Unless I mean, it's possible that, I mean, that character has not been announced as being cast, or that character just went away. So, I don't know.
Moving into DCEU news, the Birds of Prey movie is eyeing actresses Journey Smollett-Bell to play Dinah Lance, Black Canary, and Mary Elizabeth Winstead for Helena Bertinelli / Huntress. And other actresses being considered include, or other actresses being considered for Black Canary include Gugu Mbatha-Raw for Huntress. It's Kristen Milioti from How I Met Your Mother, who plays the mother, if you are not familiar with her. Sophia Boutella, interesting.
I love her.
Yes, I love her too. That would be great. And I love Gugu. She holds a special place in my heart, so that would be amazing as well. And then Margaret Qualley from The Leftovers. And then for Renee Montoya, there's Justina Machado. Ooh, from One Day at a Time.
I'm excited about that.
Yeah, I'm excited too.
And then Roberta Colendres. So
I can't find much about her. I just know that she's a Mexican actress. I think she's also, like, a writer, but I haven't really seen or heard anything about, like, what she is in. I don't think she's in anything anybody would know, but...
Yeah. Interesting. She kind of... I just looked at her photo, and I'm like, oh, okay. Oh, she's in Vita. Okay.
Yeah. But it's exciting that they have so many... You know, they're trying to be really, really inclusive, and I really appreciate that. And then just
the only kind of negative thing that I have is that you can kind of tell the type of that they're looking for. I guess it's a positive and negative. Positive is that I think, personally, I think it's Juliana Hercarby, like her impact as Black Canary on Arrow, that they're going for...
A mixed race.
Yes, a mixed race Black Canary movie. But also, you know, it's still like the Journey and Gugu, both like wonderful ladies, but they're also like the paper bag test passed it with flying colors. And, you know, it's just kind of like more of the same. Like, it's not the same light skin actresses that you see like repeated recently in a lot of like Marvel, but they're still like, you know, paper bag. Acceptable Hollywood
play. Right.
And you know, like, can we get like a mahogany table test? Like, you can't if you're not as dark as a mahogany table, you cannot shake it. Like, shake the industry up. I know that there's also like a rumor that Janelle Monáe was in the running for Black Canary. Ooh. But I think that's a bit less credible because it doesn't really seem to, she wasn't mentioned in like the article.
No, I was excited for 2.5 seconds.
Yeah, so, you know, that would have been shaking the table. For Journey or Gugu or, you know, whichever one of them gets the spot. But I just, you know, it's kind of like,
Yeah.
So.
I feel you, but... Also interesting that they're not naming anyone for Cassandra.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Because I couldn't even remember if I thought that they had cast her already or not. But it is a little weird that all of the ladies... have people looking for them except for Cassandra, which we're assuming that the Batgirl is going to be Cassandra. Did they confirm that or not? I think they confirmed.
I think they did.
So they confirmed it was Cassandra, but they didn't say anybody was playing her yet.
Yeah.
So,
yep.
But we'll hear more about this probably by next week because next week is the end of September, and that's when it says that they're going to be locking down these roles. So more official casting news will be out, and then we'll be able to talk about it next Friday, hopefully.
They have fight training.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And moving into Titans, episode 1 photos were released. What did we think about
them? Episode 2.
Episode 2 as well. I think I only saw, like, the brief promo that they released today with the changing of, like, the one character to their superhero.
Oh, yeah. Well, it looks like Raven's gonna cry a lot. And Dixon will help her. And then... I guess it was like, oh, connections, because there's a picture of Starfire looking at a photo of Raven. So I'm like, oh, Starfire's looking for Raven? Starfire knows something about Raven? Okay, interesting. And then, yeah, that's about what I got from the first episode.
She's Starfire, still the same, like, Starfire has, like, one outfit.
Yeah. We still have not seen her outside of this outfit, especially because in the episode 2 photos... which is called Hawk and Dove. Like, we see some Hawk and Dove stuff, and they've also put a dumb wig on, I've just forgotten her name, but, you know, Dove.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. On Lyra from Friday Night Lights. Lila from Friday Night Lights. But anyway, yes. So she's got a dumb blonde wig, but that's fine. It's, like, literally all photos of Hawk and Dove and some family that I don't know who this family is. Maybe it's, like, Raven's scary family. Like, I don't know what's going on. This lady looks wild. Like, she looks like a Stepford wife that's going to kill you.
Minka Kelly.
Thank you, Minka Kelly.
Yeah.
But there's no photos of Beast Boy anywhere. Does he exist? I don't know. And in episode 2, there's no photos of Starfire either. So we still don't know what the hell she's going to wear after she takes off that disco dress.
I do think, like, in the group shot that they released of all four of them standing together, like, that, like... Anna's pose, like, she was like kick-ass looking one. Like, all the other ones was like, they just rolled out of bed and shut up. And like, oh, hey, we're doing this now. And Anna was like,
she was making it work.
Yeah. She looks really good.
I think, so I don't know. It seems.
I was going to say, I think she's, like, she seems super invested in her character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just by the photos, so hopefully, you know, that'll actually, hopefully the show's just good. I don't even know anymore. And that she gets
We're
her due.
We're getting her control.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah. Moving into Funko Pop, original Funko, we're watching you, controversy. So last week, they released a new Funko Pops for the Flash, which included Vibe, Kid Flash, and Jay Garrick, and a new version mm-hmm. of Barry, and no women. Yeah, no women. And then a couple hours later, they released the Killer Frost New York Comic Con exclusive, and mm-hmm. no Iris. So
mm-hmm.
that pissed everybody off because of all the women, she's the leading lady, and she still doesn't have a Funko. And they refuse, and they're acting brand new, you know, as if no one's been saying that they want one for the
right.
last.
Right, I've been
five
asking
years.
For them for 5 years.
It's yeah. annoying because season one, when like I think it was right after they Funko was like, "Oh, Felicity fans, we hear you. Thanks for like the chocolate or something that they did and got them a Felicity Funko Pop." And then, you know, people started asking, well, what about, you know, Iris and all that kind of stuff. It's like, yeah, we'll take your notes. Like, there's, like, an actual person from Funko. Like, yeah, I'll start working on this. And then nothing for the next
right.
4 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, Candace has mentioned that, you know, expressed interest in wanting one and, like, promoting it and all this kind of stuff. And then the whole kind of fallout. I think Danielle knew that she was getting a pop.
Oh, yeah, she absolutely
I don't
think
did. Candace didn't. She probably didn't know when it was going to be released. And so when Funko released their Flash line and she wasn't mm-hmm. in, she was like, what about me? And mm-hmm. Candace, I doubt Candace knew that she was getting a pop, that Danielle was getting a pop. And so Candace was like, well, what about all these women? And she like listed everybody, you know, mm-hmm. Caitlin, Jesse, Nora, Cecile, listing everybody. I think Candace knew that Danielle was getting a pop. And I think a lot of people were, some people were upset with him for not advocating for Candace, but I do think that he knew Danielle was getting a pop, so it was kind of like,
yeah,
he was helping his friend out, getting them to...
Right,
like,
he was just promoting it. The reveal
just
of that.
Something that he already knew was going to happen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's what that was.
Yeah.
But it is like, ridiculous overall that, like, you know, and the same with Laurel Lance, Black Canary for Arrow, doesn't have a pop still. Mm-hmm. And they blame it on things like licensing or whatever, but I can't imagine that.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
It is kind of weird, yeah. Like, I just don't know what the reason would be. Like, why wouldn't you make an Iris pop doll? It doesn't make sense. Yeah. Other than just, like, you want to make suited ones. Sure. Like, I just want to make
right,
superheroes.
But that makes no sense either,
like,
because
why?
Felicity is not suited, and she has
yeah.
one.
Right.
Well, she has... She had one earlier on, and when maybe they like so maybe after the Felicity thing, we're like, we're only doing superhero pops. But then you still have Laurel, who's a superhero, and didn't get one.
Yeah.
I had a speedster episode. She's right. basically a superhero now. She has a superhero suit. So if it's like consistency and like we don't know Iris is a journalist. She doesn't have like a signature journalist look that she always wears. Well, now she has a super suit that you know is not going to be changing every time she puts it on. So that would have been something, especially with Killer Frost. To bring out, like, Speedster Iris and Killer Frost at the same time. And they also announced Kara for the New York Comic-Con exclusives. So, like, those would have been, if you wanted to bring all three girls out, even, like,
right.
as Jesse Quick doesn't have one, and she's a superhero.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, where is the line? Where are you drawing this line about who gets the pop and who doesn't?
Right.
It
doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it doesn't. And whatever. It's just really obnoxious. But on the plus side... Now that Candace tweeted about, like, missed opportunities, a lot of, you know, websites picked it up and basically, like, were tagging, or you know, Funko in their tweets and whatever. So I'm sure that they know that people are just kind of annoyed that they won't release
yeah.
it. But moving into our episode, Jessica's...
Final.
Yes, finally, after, like, 25 minutes. I'll catch up.
2 weeks. There's a lot of news.
This episode was inspired by... Jessica's Reverse Flash Anons, who kind of kept asking her about villains and big bads of the Arrowverse. So we'll talk about the source material in the comics, how they were adopted for TV, and which ones were kind of iconic, which ones flopped, which ones were the wild card and the underdog. And then Jessica, who is our host for this episode, will let you know all about it. Take it away, Jess.
Yeah, so basically, I started getting some, like, Reverse Flash anons about, you know, what it would be like for, what would it take for Eobard and Barry to be, like, forced to work together or something like that. And I kind of, like, went into more things about Eobard as a villain and, you know, how he could have been used better in the show and things like that. And so it got me kind of thinking about big bads in general in the Arrowverse. And so the way that we kind of break this down, I came up with some categories for the villains for each show. We're not going to go through every single villain because we'd be here for, like, ever. So just pick, like, a couple. And the categories are the GOAT, the G-O-A-T, the greatest of all time. So this is a villain. I'm looking at it from, like, a series perspective. So over the course of the series, this villain that has the most development, larger-than-life personality, very compelling, truly iconic, makes the show. The villain that you want to see the most in the show that did, like, made the most impact would be the GOAT. Underdog. This is a villain that's kind of, like, riding in the middle. They're not iconic status yet, but there's potential there. Maybe they need some more development, but they're a little bit mysterious or a little bit underdeveloped at the moment, but there's potential. Wild card, this is the villain that no one expected to make a lasting impression. Like, maybe they were a one-off villain. They only had a... they're a villain of the week that turned into a recurring role or more based off of the charisma of the character and or the actress or actor that was playing them. And then you have the flops. So the flops are the villains that have all this great backstory and source material, probably have a huge following in the comics realm or other mediums like DC Animated Universe, but it just doesn't live up to the hype on screen in live action format. Like, these are the villains that just... you know, the writers dropped the ball and turned a great villain into kind of a mediocre or hot mess. So, those are the categories. First up, we have Supergirl. And we picked out, because Supergirl, they struggle in general with having big bad arcs, I think. So, we decided to pick Daxam because season two had... Mon-El's mother turned into the big bad at the back half of the season, but I don't really think that she's, like, strong in the comics verse. We just did Daxam as a whole. And then Rain, of course, the Luthers as a general, because Lillian is the only, like, villain that we've had so far from the Luther family, and Livewire. So first up is Daxam. And in the comics, Daxamites were a group of Kryptonians who had left Krypton in order to explore the universe. They're an intensely xenophobic race, fearful of alien invaders. They tend to stay in their home world. They're not vulnerable to Kryptonite because this program called the Eradicator programmed to preserve all Kryptonian culture, altered the birthing matrix so that instead of Kryptonite being their... Kryptonite, it's lead, is now their new vulnerability, which carried through into the show. Daxamites manifest their powers and abilities similar to those of Superman when exposed to the light of the yellow star, which includes strength, damage resistance, speed, flight, x-ray vision. Their own son is a red giant. Valor is their son. So while in the world, they didn't have any of their powers. I don't remember, do you guys know about, like, why Kryptonites and Daxamites were kind of like butting heads and against each other? It could just be because Daxamites are xenophobes and, like, kind of racist. So.
Yeah, I mean, they touched a little bit on it on the show, like how they owned slaves, basically, and stuff like that.
Yes.
But, yeah, comic-wise, I don't know.
Yeah. But basically, for me, I classify them on the show as flops because... Mon-El is a whole flop.
Yeah.
I don't think, you know, when even introducing his parents that it really did anything. You didn't really learn any more about Daxam as a planet or as a race or what his family was like in the back half to really kind of build any kind of depth to it other than the fact that, you know, Dax and Krypton don't get along. And, you know, that was supposed to, like, carry the whole arc all the way through, and it just, like, kind of didn't for me. But what did you guys think?
I agree with you that they are flops. And I think that it's unfortunate. Like, this is one case where I think that doing it closer to the comic book interpretation would have been better, just in the sense that, like, the xenophobia is a really important part of at least the pre-crisis version of the Daxonites. And I think that, like, the Eradicator, for example, is a much more interesting version, is a much more interesting character than just, like, Mom-El, right? Mm-hmm. What was it? Like, Kara's thing is that she, as a Kryptonian, is interacting with, like, mixing with humans, right? So, like, if you're going to take the metaphor, which the Pittsburgh world loves to have their little allegories about discrimination, about racism, or about just, you know, divisiveness or coming together, etc., then Daxamites wanting to eradicate Kara because she's mixing with humans would have been a more interesting way of doing that than whatever vagueness they were trying to do with
And then, like, they wanted the Mom-El wanted Mon-El to marry
Lena. Which totally undermines the
whole
everything.
Thing. Yeah. So throw that out the window.
Yeah, so
Lena was the exception, like, guys. The exception.
Yeah. And then they had to have, like, I don't know. The way they did it was, like, first it's like, oh, through Mon-El, Kara learned that not all Daxamites were that bad. Sometimes they're just nice dudes who still own slaves. And then the mom comes, and her husband and whoever else showed up. I don't remember how many people were left, like three people. And it's like, actually, all Daxamites are garbage, except for Mon-El, who is only, like, three-fourths garbage. So thank you for sharing that information with me. It just, I don't know, like, I don't... Season 2 of Supergirl was super directionless, and switching from Cadmus and Lillian Luthor to the Daxamites and Rhea made it feel even more directionless. Like, it didn't give any weight to the season, and I don't know, like, what theme they were trying to present with that villain.
And, like, Kara, it even made Kara seem a little bit... like, ridiculous, because she was so, like, against Daxon. But, like, you left when you were a kid, so how do you even know what war between Daxonites is supposed to be like? You know, other than it's like, you can hate Mon-El just because he's an asshole, but you don't have to need a whole history of, like, being against Daxon to not like him. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree. This one is, like... This one was super unfortunate for me because I love Terry Hatcher and I feel like they absolutely did her wrong. And then the Daxon started off on the wrong foot, and that began with Mon-El's arrival. So, like, what was supposed to be, like, a Luthor big bad of the season turned into a Daxon big bad, and it's, like, hard to really say anything good about them because they flopped so hard and were just terrible people. And their storyline got tied back to Mon-El, and then about going to reclaim Daxam or whatever, but it just came in too late, you know? So I think Terry Hatcher was, like, a joy to watch for me personally, but there wasn't enough material to make anything happening believable. And the Daxams never seemed like a major threat, even, regardless of, like, the reasons that they came and what they were gonna do. And, like, you want to take your son back with you? Yes, please do that. I think they could have redeemed him even by saying he's going to go back and, like, do right by his society what was done wrong in the past, you know? But they didn't do that. Uh-huh. So the whole story was turned into, let's save Mon-El, and, man, maybe your potential in-laws are trash, Kara. So, like, on paper, I think they sounded grand and awesome, but their on-screen presence and story proved to be super underwhelming and not very memorable. And honestly, I think they were introduced so as to make Mon-El look like the good guy and do the self-sacrificing thing at the end, which failed.
Yeah, basically, they were introduced in, like, rush, kind of. I think they were rushed because that's when the writers decided to push the whole Mon-El and Kara situation. And so they needed, like, some kind of thing for them. And so that's how we went from Luthers to Daxamites. So, like, the push from Supercore baiting to Mon-El, Kara-Mel baiting was, like, the... Mm-hmm. Switch from Luthor to Daxon, big bad, I think.
I agree. Same. I agree with this.
It just felt like for Lillian Luther, her arc, I think it was like the mid-season finale of season two, which was good. And then it just kind of disappeared. So that should have
been. Well, let's talk about Lillian, shall we? the Luthers are the big bads of Superman's universe and also Supergirl. With Superman and Lex, Clark and Lex is kind of like a, I think they were initially on the same side, used to be friends, and kind of like fell out because of their different ideologies. And Lex distrust. He doesn't. Lex is kind of like I don't know if he's Machiavellian. Kind of.
He's a little Machiavellian.
Yeah. Like his whole thing is that no man should be invincible or invulnerable, and that's kind of like what Superman is, because he doesn't really have a lot of. Or any weaknesses, he only has that one, and so like Lex is always trying to like one up Superman or like have that, you know, make it so that he is not all powerful kind of thing. So he's a smart villain, and on Supergirl we get that in Lena, but kind of like an origin of Lena. So you have Lena and Kara that are kind of friendly. In the comics, Lena is in a wheelchair though, so that's a little bit of a departure that didn't need to happen. But it did, so. So I don't really know what the difference, you know, making her go from being in a wheelchair to not being in a wheelchair, what that added to the show, because it didn't seem like it added anything.
Right.
But she in the show is Kara's Lex. They are still in friendly kind of territory, but as we were talking about earlier in the last part of season three, you see the strain start to come in. You kind of see where the ideologies start to split off between mm-hmm. Lena and Kara. So hopefully that they go further and actually that pays off. But for the Luthers, I classify them for the series as a whole right now. They're still the underdogs. Mm-hmm. Lillian didn't really make much of a splash for me, just because they cut her villain arc off way too short. And then Lena is still in that kind of gray area where you can kind of see where she could be bad and see where the ideology split off from Kara and see where that tension could be, but they haven't really pulled the trigger on it yet. What do you guys think?
Well, on Supergirl, I feel like we agree on all things. So I definitely also would put the Luthers as the underdog. Although I guess I have like a slightly more favorable impression, and just that I think that Lillian works really well if you're thinking of the main story, you know, villain or not wise, as Lena, right? So Lillian as being what Lena could turn into if she follows down that same path is really interesting, and all of their interactions I think are very rich, and you can see like there's like the side of good and evil, right? But at the same time, Lillian sometimes makes good points. And sometimes we see Lillian in Lena's actions, right? So that's the whole little like Ravenclaw, Slytherin, I don't know, whatever. Okay. But in terms of her being the leader of Cadmus, like that part totally like fell apart, and we don't even need to ever see Cadmus again. Aside from maybe to tell us what the hell Jeremiah Danvers is doing now, because I seriously, like, racking my brain, cannot remember what happened to Jeremiah Danvers and why nobody cares anymore. But, yeah. Except for, like, I guess once every 10 episodes, Alex is like, my father.
And Kara's like, but yeah. Yeah, no.
So the more interesting part for the Luthers is also the part that is the most unknown, which I think is why they're like, it's like the underdog, but also it's not really a wild card, but it's like they're the underdog because we don't know if they're ever going to, like you said, we don't know if they're going to pull the trigger on it. Like will Lena turn evil or become an antagonist? She doesn't have to be evil, but just like her path diverged enough from Supergirl's that they're going to be at odds. Right. So like on the one hand, constantly waiting for the other shoe to drop and having Lena do like ambiguous things. So that then you can be like, psych, she was good the whole time. Is kind of hamstrings her character, but on the other, it's also like keeps people invested in her and in the story, because everything that she does is justified to some degree, right? Because we are frustrated as viewers with how she's being treated, and we see like all these people like refusing to acknowledge the things that she's done or sort of refusing to believe in her, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So once you've been told enough times that you're something,
it's like tends to of a good supervillain origin story.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. And I looked up Lena, just really quickly, like, Wikipedia'd her, and there, she doesn't have, like, a lot of in-depth material from the comics, it seemed like. Some, the pre-crisis version, she's Lex's sister. Post-crisis, she's his daughter. Then post-Infinite Crisis, she's his sister again. And she doesn't really seem to be... She has a lot of storylines with Brainiac. Doesn't really... Well, there's, like, Brainiac 13, and then I don't know if there's, like, another Brainiac at another point that, like, she had, like, psychic emphatic abilities that was, like, implanted in her brain, and then brain surgery, she lost them. So there's not, like, a lot of things to work with, so they are, I think, basing her off of Lex pretty much for the show version.
Yeah. What I think is interesting, because in the show, and I don't know if that's this is true of the comics, she's adopted, right? If I remember correctly?
In the show, she's adopted, show. But I think it was... I think it's, like, hinted that she is actually his daughter, but, like, he had an affair.
Right, okay.
And he's actually
so there's, like,
the dad's daughter.
This weird relationship with her mom in terms of, like, that dynamic, so that's, like, super layered, because it's, like, you're my daughter, I raised you, but you're not biologically mine, and there's, like, that whole idea of, like, whether she is truly a Luther for her, like you were saying, and it's also interesting because if we're going to look at Lena... who isn't the main female of the show, but she has, like, the most layered dynamic with a mother figure, whereas Kara does not. So it's just, like, a fascinating relationship that they have, even though I think that they could do a lot more with it. Like, I think the first half of season two was good in the sense that they started to build that tension, and we could see kind of where it was going. But at the same time, the overall... you know, the overarching big bad storyline for Lillian wasn't exactly strong at all. So she's more like a passing villain and not someone who you can really look to be super attached to Kara in any way. So if she's going to be brought back, she's going to be Lena's villain, I guess, even though she's her mom.
Right.
But, like, she's still going to be Lena's villain. And that's an interesting thing to see on the show. But as far as, like, an overall Supergirl villain... she's not quite there yet, so they might just turn Lena into what Lillian could have been.
Moving on to...
like, that's it, that's all.
That's it. Moving on to the GOAT, of this series, I would say that Rain is by far the strongest, most developed villain that Supergirl has done. She kind of fell off a little bit in the back half, and I'll get back to that. But in the comics, Rain is a world killer, biological weapon created on Krypton. But the world killers were eventually outlawed by the Kryptonian Science Council. They were created by Zor-El, so Kara's father, which I thought they were going to do, change that to be Kara's mom on the show, but I don't, then she turned out not to be a part of it because she's a nice white lady, and they don't do that. but, I mean, at least in the comics, he later came to regret his part in the creation of those monsters, so whatever. Rain and her fellow world killers survived Krypton, but she didn't know her origin. It remained a mystery even to her, so that kind of carried over into the show. Also, but she knows that she was a world killer, and that... the answers to what she's supposed to be doing is either on Krypton or on Earth. But when she goes to Krypton, she finds out it's dead, but she tracks down Supergirl to Argo City and kind of tries to beat the truth out of Kara, but of course Kara doesn't know. So she leaves Kara on Argo and then goes to Earth to, like, conquer the planet. And then that's when Supergirl and Rain go head-to-head, and Rain and three of her world killers try to, like, defeat Supergirl, but they are unsuccessful. And then Rain opts to retreat, and they leave Earth, but vowing, of course, that she will fight Supergirl again. Da 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 da. So that is her kind of story in the comics. On the show, they went one step further, and that Sam doesn't even know that she's a world killer. So you have that whole kind of build up story. And then in the first half of the season, the back half is when stuff starts really picking up and going. I think that she's the strongest villain that the series has had, because they were very, they seemed like they had a plan for the first time of the big bad and where they wanted the big bad to go, and mm-hmm. introducing Sam early and like focusing on her, giving her development so you can see the kind of progression from Sam to Rain, I thought was really in depth, but it was also kind of long. Because there's a lot of times where I'm like, well, okay, when is she gonna like figure out that she's not normal, and when is this gonna kick off, and why does she turn into Rain? And you know, there's a lot of questions that I think that they drew out a little bit longer than should have been drawn out. And then of course there's the whole mess with the other two world killers, Pestilence and Purity, not being nearly as developed or spent nearly enough time. And in the comics, it seems like she's like, Rain is the leader, but she also cares about her world killer partners. Like they're a group, like they're a troop, a military kind of group that care about each other. Whereas on the show, it's not, doesn't really seem like that at all. And they are, you know, just extra food sources for Rain to later absorb when they die, is what it seems like. But what do you guys think about Rain on Supergirl and how she was adapted?
Well, she's definitely the GOAT of the series, but in a you know, like, this is the best of kind of sorry bunch kind of way. Yeah. Not that she's bad, like, she's great, but the parts that are great about her are the parts that were added by the show, as in Sam, right? Like, you still like Sam being the one who doesn't know, and then fighting against her programming, basically, once she finds out. Like, that's what makes Rain so compelling as a villain, because we're rooting, basically, for Sam's rehabilitation, for Sam to rescue Sam. Like, save Sam is really, like, is more interesting or important than, you know, don't let the world killer destroy the world. Because, yeah, obviously the world killer's not going to destroy the world, or else there won't be a season 4 of Supergirl. So it's more it's more interesting to have that human side of it. Because we don't know, like, they could have killed Sam if they wanted to, you know? They could have been depressing as heck, and then Alex could have taken care of her child. But moving on, I've passed that boat. The ship has sailed. Okay, so,
You tried. Anyway, you tried your hardest.
I did. I tried my hardest. Not that I wanted Sam to die, but I did want, you know, her to stick around. Okay, so everything else, though, like, aside from Sam being awesome, and like, and then, you know, even the redemption with her mom, which was really sad and beautiful and whatever, like the religious aspect, the whole like, oh, this is like the world killer religion is like evil for some reason and we just want to kill people, like, it just wasn't really very well developed. I didn't really care about it, and the other two world killers seemed really unnecessary and downright insulting at times. Like, oh, let's have these women of color come in so they can die or sacrifice themselves and then make Rain stronger. Didn't love that. So all of that stuff is like not great. But one thing that Rain does do, right, through her ideology, which is totally opposite of Kara's, is make a nice and important contrast for us to see, like, why it's so important that Kara sticks to her ideals, right? Like the time when she was gonna kill Rain, or allow Rain to be killed, and then she had to turn back time, because it was so awful that she was immediately... Yes! She was immediately shown that living her way is terrible. But, ironically, I would say that the dude that we hated, Arya's dad from Pretty Little Liars, Thomas something, I don't remember his name. Colville, thank you. Yes. So, he was actually one of the best embodiments of that theme, which is, like, he was worshipping Kara, right? But then he chose to turn to Rain and, like, follow that path, right? The path of violence, the path of darkness, the path of revenge, all that stuff, because he was way too bloody for Kara in the first place. And then he gets his ass killed because those people have no loyalty, and...
But he's not dead, all. Tati.
Oh. Sorry, you're right. He's not dead. He's probably gonna come back next season because we didn't see his body. But yes.
Like, I think the thing that annoys me the most, or underwhelms me the most about Rain as a villain, is what you said. Like, you know, Sam, great. Sam has all this development. Sam has all this heart in her story. Rain does not. And, like, the whole religion aspect of it, they didn't really get into it. And I think that building up that more and that kind of ideology, instead of just like saying that it's there and expecting us to be like, okay, you know, would have made Rain a lot more interesting as Rain and not as Sam. Because sometimes I don't think even Rain knew why she was supposed to be doing the things she was doing.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, she was a strong villain for the in terms of the show, like you guys said. But she's like, so she made an impact, but I think it was definitely Sam. So, like, with Supergirl having a history of weak, season-long big bads, Rain was kind of a breath of fresh air at first. Like, she had the sympathetic backstory, or at least Sam did. She was a working mom, a friend to the ladies of the show, and so watching her become Rain was hard on the audience, you know? So she wasn't the best of the best as a villain nearer to the end of season three, but at least the writers really took into consideration Sam's backstory, even though this same backstory didn't work for Rain. So, like, as a character, she left a lasting impression on the show. But a big part of that for me was, like, Odette Annabelle's portrayal of her. And, like, Rain is tricky because she is the greatest of all time. But at the same time, for me, she's also a flop. Because, like, there's two sides of the coin. So, like, Sam was the greatest of all time. And without Sam, Rain would pretty much be this one-note villain who just kind of followed orders and didn't have any real agency of her own.
Fair. And lastly, in this very long super Livewire, I put as like the wild card because, you know, she's the one that she's supposed to be like a one-off one episode or so, but I think she had a couple of like recurring episodes in season one, and then she came back, you know, she skipped a whole season, came back in season three, which kind of just shows you like how popular she was as like a character that they brought her back, and then they killed her off, so you know. But in the comics, Leslie Willis, aka Livewire, was a popular kind of shock jock who made a habit of ridiculing Superman, so she's a Superman villain. And her outspoken and polarizing style garnered her many supporters as well as people that didn't like her so much. Lex Luthor loved her show, but like Clark was kind of like, you know, whatever, like she's just making a living. It didn't really bother him that much, but so for the show, I think that they connected her to Kat Grant because she was like former protege of Kat's, right? Mm-hmm. And then she turned into like a shock jock personality and became an antagonist for Kara instead of an antagonist for Clark. I didn't watch season one, so I missed like a large portion of probably what made her great. So I'm gonna like to you guys and get your thoughts about Livewire.
I just thought that she was one of the few villains, especially in season one, that had a personal connection to the other characters and had like a specific reason for why they went a little villainous. Like obviously there was the aunt, like, I can't remember her name. Is her name Astra, or is that the mom? Allura's mom. Thank you. So yeah, so there's Astra, who obviously she had her personal reasons, but Livewire had like a personal vendetta against Kat Grant, and we got to see a little bit of like how, you know, like she had the fight with Kat, like she gets fired, whatever, right? So she has, and then she ends up like dying, right? indirectly because of Kat.
Yeah.
So it was cool to see her like, you know, wanting to get her revenge based on that. And even though it's like, you know, kind of nonsensical, like you're like, okay, well, you're being a little dramatic, but you got where she was coming from. It wasn't just like, hello, I've decided to be evil today. So that was cool. And then I really liked her team up with Banshee, Silver Banshee in, I think that was also season one, right? That was still season one.
It was, yeah. Didn't they team up during, because she was in the Flash Supergirl crossover, wasn't she? When Barry first crossed over, it was yes. Livewire that was there.
Yes, but I don't think that was the first time that they teamed up. I think they teamed up again.
It was the second time. Yeah.
Right, but so it was nice that there was like a bit of continuity with her because there aren't that many villains on Supergirl that reoccur. So it was nice to build up a little bit. Like she did feel a little bit like the sneak preview Captain Cold kind of character of Supergirl. And then even following the trajectory of being able to be reached, like you could reach out to her and have her help against Rain, right? Like she can be reasoned with. She's someone who obviously is out for like self-preservation, but also isn't trying to just destroy everything, right? She's not, I don't know, chaotic evil. So yeah, That's why I found her really interesting, and I'm sad that they cut it short because there's many more places they could have gone with her instead of just, like, one tearjerker scene that was just then never brought up again.
Yeah, I mean, I likened her to Captain Cole as well. Like, back in season one, I just remember thinking Livewire was probably the most memorable of all the villains because I can't remember any villain from season one. Like, she was, like, the kind of villain you could see popping up every once in a while and just kind of annoying Kara and being snarky and just doing whatever she wanted. But while it was fun and, you know, she had this strange, interesting relationship with her, but then they killed her and there was nothing else left. So she was engaging and there was a lot of potential and it was good while it lasted, but Supergirl really just fucked up. That's all. I'm still mad about this.
My feelings are hurt.
Are they too hurt to move on to Arrow?
We're never too hurt to bitch about Arrow.
Let's go over to Arrow and Star City. So, for Arrow, I chose to talk about Slade Wilson, a.k.a. Deathstroke. Ra's al Ghul, and then either and or Deadshot or Black Siren. So first up is Slade Wilson, and as a series, Arrow as a series, I put him as the GOAT, the GOAT, because I just think that he's the most, again, like, he's the most developed, and he's the one that when people talk about, you remember when Arrow is good, it's always Slade Wilson and Deathstroke. So, like, looking back into the comics area, like, he's got, like, a wide variety of comics that he's appeared over, from Teen Titans, Judas Contract. It looks like it's mainly Titans. He has a lot of, like, Titans. Birds of Prey, he was in stories. A lot of DC Animated Universe, he shows up a lot. And basically his backstory is that he entered the U.S. Army when he was, like, 16, and built up his skills. He met Captain Adeline Kane, who was tasked with training young soldiers in new fighting techniques, and he was kind of like a savant in that he just picked up all these fighting styles really well, really great fighter, and actually wound up marrying Adeline Kane, which I think is weird, but yeah. You're probably closer in age than, you know, whatever. But the reason that he became Deathstroke was because the army kind of chose him for a secret experiment because they wanted to make soldiers with enhanced physical powers. So basically they wanted to make metahuman super soldiers for the military. And he became a mercenary, but he, like, wound up, like, defying the orders of the military to rescue his friend who was sent on Wintergreen, who was sent on a suicide mission. And so he kind of, like, starts, like, keeping this, like, super, like, side career from his family, and that kind of, like, put a divide in between them. So you can kind of see how that part eventually made its way into the Arrowverse with last season when we started to get his son and that kind of backstory, and Slade hiding his secret profession from his kid while they were, like, camping or whatever. Mm-hmm. Again, for me, on the show, I think that he was the most developed and the most charismatic of the villains that they've had. And it kind of shows to his credit that he kept coming back even after they, I think he was, like, a big bad for two seasons, mm-hmm. instead of just one. So, like, that already shows kind of his impact. And then, you know, the whole, like, the villain that is a villain long enough to become a frenemy. Because he and Oliver's, like, towards the end, basically have reached a point where they're kind of, right. like, at each other. So that, I think that's another reason, or another way that you can tell that this villain is so charismatic and so popular and so loved in the fandom and the writer's room, is when they go from villain to, like, frenemy. But what did you guys think of Slade?
I would put Slade as, I mean, he's not really an underdog, but like, the second best to GOAT seems like underdog, and that's why I put him there. Just because he wasn't my favorite, but he had a lot of potential, and he was really great, especially in season one, when you see, like, that developing dynamic between them, and, like, you see, like, the way that he's going to become a villain. And also, Manny Bennett played him really well, and him as a villain in season two creates a lot of guilt and anguish for Oliver. So all of that was great. But I feel like the comic book character is so iconic and is so different from the Slade that we see in the show that it was kind of like, it was like, especially, and the way that, like, they sacrifice Shadow to make Blade's story be, like, angsty man pain. Plus, half of it was, like, Mirakuru stuff, and I just want to erase Mirakuru from my mind. So I'm like, I don't like you that much, Slade, even though at first I really liked you. Him coming back in season six, like you said, is a good sign that they really like him. And, like, obviously they want to make it work for him. Like, they probably think that he's their goat. I don't know how you use this acronym. Anyway.
But I feel like, do you think that Arrow has a goat or not? If you don't think it's Deathstroke, then do you think they have one?
Well, he's dead, but Prometheus. That would be mine.
Oh, Prometheus. Yeah.
So.
How dare you?
I know.
Sorry.
Well, it's because he's played by my boyfriend Josh Segarra, so I could never forget him. But our relationship is new, but it's going very well. Thank you.
She moved on past the divorce. Everything is fine.
Yeah. Anyway, just kidding.
The divorce is finalized.
Exactly. The divorce is finalized. I'm ready to step out. Okay. But anyway. Point is that Adrian, like, so the character, like, in the comics, Prometheus seems ridiculous. Like, I've never read an issue with Prometheus, but he starts off, it's like, he's like a Blue Beetle villain, and then he's like Justice League, and he's got like a, I don't know, he's like got some cybernetic stuff, like he's a little bit like Cyborg, and also at some point he has like aliens, like he like kills the leader of like an alien leader of some cult, and then like steals their like spaceship travel abilities. I don't know, it just all sounds like nonsense. So clearly, Arrow and Prometheus is nothing like that, but in the best possible way. So,
kind of like flip-flop. Like, Deathstroke has all of this great comic backstory that they didn't really take advantage of in the show, whereas Prometheus is super ridiculous in the comics, and they changed all of that for the better in the show.
Yes. And, like, the thing is, too, like, when they finally brought in some of that backstory, like, with his son, I'm talking about Slade right now, in season six, that episode was so boring that I fell asleep. So, I don't know. It did not translate correctly. But with Prometheus, like, they, again, I always go back to, like, which villains are the most thematically relevant for the character, right? And I think Prometheus was really great in season five of, like, I'm going to make Oliver realize that he's a killer, right? I'm going to show him that he's just as bad as the villains. And since some of us did feel that way, it was very interesting to witness Oliver having to sort of face himself in that manner. And also, I like the parallel of, like, you killed my father, so I'm going to expose you to your son kind of thing. Like, that whole thing is really interesting to me. It's like a cool, like, dark mirror to Oliver. And again, Slade does have some of that, especially in the early season. Like, it's like, you are the reason that the woman that I love is dead, so I'm going to take the woman that you love. Like, so, you know, like, yes, that does exist. But I thought that Prometheus was, like, the best it's going to get for Arrow.
I agree, actually, about, well, yes, for me,
Deathstroke was my greatest of all time before Prometheus showed up. And I have to agree with Tati that he is the one for Arrow. So I agree with your assessment, because I think when I think back on all the Arrow's villains, like, the strongest one for me was Prometheus. And, like, Slade had longer arc in terms of development and seeing exactly when the turn happened toward being against Oliver. But Prometheus was far scarier and, like, way more personal for Oliver. Like, he got into his head and affected him in a way no other villain has. And I feel like the repercussions were so bad that he even had him taunting him in his head when he was poisoned in season six. So I really helped that Josh Segarra was one of the best actors the show has ever had and really sold Prometheus's anger, his desire for Oliver to truly see himself as a monster and exactly why he came after him. So I think that specifically for Oliver, Prometheus was, like, the one who really got under his skin. And he lasted long enough to not become a frenemy. But, like, they killed him off, which is a shame. But, like,
at least you know he lasted when long enough to die.
Yeah, but, like, he didn't last long enough. Like, when they brought him back, they found a creative way to do it. So he's still, like, fucking with Oliver's head, you know? Versus Slade's like, come help me in some country get my son back. But it's not as great anymore because we're not like that. You know, it's like weird. I mean, for Deathstroke, I mean, he was compelling in the beginning. Like, the development was headed in the right direction. I loved him season one. I remember watching like one episode twice, which I've never done for Arrow before. So they certainly painted him as a guy you could understand before everything just went downhill. So it was kind of how Lex and Clark were friends on Smallville before things changed and they did become enemies. So that was like Deathstroke in a nutshell. But then season six happened and he was kind of like, they brought him back because they liked him, but his impact was lacking.
I see. We have a goat. We have an underdog. The flop, I think, is Ra's al Ghul, which is like horrible because in the comics, like he has one of like the biggest impacts. And he's a Batman villain, first of all. Mm-hmm. he's got so much, like, comic book history across all different series in the DCAU as well. Character overview, he is an international and criminal terrorist mastermind. His name means head of the ghoul, or chief demon in Arabic.
Yeah, demon's head. Demon's head.
The demon's head, yeah. And his ultimate goal is a world in perfect environmental balance, which he believes the best way to achieve this balance is to eliminate most of humanity. So that doesn't work for me, but he usually tries to solve the world's population using like some kind of like biological weapon. He's how you get to the Lazarus pit, the whole restoring the dead and coming back to life. He's the one that kind of like addresses Batman as the detective and kind of like regards Batman as like up there as like his equal, like his worthiest opponent. He is Damian Wayne's grandfather.
So really he is the goat, but he is.
Yeah. In the comics, he is the goat, but on the show, he is a flop.
He is a flop.
They just took off. And I think part of the reason that I think he's a flop is because I feel like I'm pretty sure they called him Roz for most of Arrow until they changed it. So they fucked up his name, first of all. And then, like, there was the fact that they tried to...
Well, did they? Because is he regularly referred to as Ra's?
I don't think so. Okay. I feel like they changed his pronunciation later on in the season. Or I don't know if I'm mistaken.
Yeah,
like,
they definitely pronounce it differently than Gotham pronounced it. I remember that.
Yeah,
how does Gotham pronounce it?
What is the correct pronunciation of his name?
I mean, in Arabic directly, it's Ra's al Ghul, so it's like Ra's al Ghul.
Ra's al Ghul is the correct pronunciation.
Yeah.
So
in most mediums, they pronounce it Ra's, but
yeah, because I remember Batman the animated series did, and I used to like get super annoyed. But
so the correct pronunciation is so then whoever said Ra's is actually more correct.
Yeah.
Well, then I take it. whoever pronounces his name correctly, you get a gold star and a cookie.
However, that being said, Gotham did cast Alexander Siddig.
Yes.
Whereas Arrow cast him with this white dude. So
yeah. So that's another way that it kind of like a little bit of a ding. Like take away the cookie, take away half a cookie. But also, I feel
Amber would like to remind us that Christopher Nolan also casted some white dude.
Yeah.
With Liam Neeson.
Stop casting British white dudes.
And then Christopher Nolan also cast a white dude as Bane.
Yeah.
That's true. White dude is Bane.
So, like, you know, stay over there, Christopher Nolan. But I think the thing that, for me, that flopped the hardest was the fact that they tried to recreate this relationship between Ra's and Batman with... you know, dollar store Batman, Queen, and it just did not work, and it didn't translate, and the whole thing with, like, using him, I don't know, like, it didn't really, it felt like an imitation, Mm-hmm. And it shouldn't feel like an imitation with the kind of, like, villain that he is. It just felt like they were trying hard to make it something that it wasn't.
Yeah.
But what did you guys think?
I agree with you. Everything about Ra's al Ghul? Yeah. That dude? This man? Yeah. Yes, the demon's head was, like, how do you make the League of Assassins boring? I don't know how you do it, but Arrow did it. and, like, aside from the fact, like, why is he white? It's, like, why is the League just a bunch of, like, political ascension struggles, right? Especially when, like, the most, like, obvious choice, which is Nyssa, is right there, but unknown reason, sexism, I don't know, she can't do it. And then they bring Merlin into it, which, by the way, we didn't even bring up Merlin here, but Merlin is, like, the super flop. He's, like, the floppiest flop. He's just such a flop, but we don't even need to talk about how he flopped. And I love John Barrowman, but, like, bringing, like, the fact that you've got Merlin in there messing with the League, like, if Merlin is able to mess with the League and, like,
that's the League.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what are you doing? You're wrong. That's how bad you are at your job. And then, of course, you know, like, killing off Sarah, just so they could have a mystery, like a mystery science thriller with the League that was super boring and made me want to die. Oh, this was bad. And then, yeah, we don't even get to see, like, Nyssa is the most interesting part of the League. And, like, obviously I would love to see why she stuck around for as long as she did and how she changed it afterwards. But, like, that's what we get to see the least of, right? She had to, like, struggle against everyone to get her rightful position as the next whatever you call Demon's Head. You know, I don't know. Whatever she is now. The leader of the League. And we don't even get to see it. So all that time was wasted. I hate it. The end.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree. I think, like, he's, like Jess said, his backstory, his comic story, all of that is just, he should be the greatest of all time. And they just got super lazy by imitating the Bat. It was like watching that episode even of Batman the Animated Series way back in the day when they first introduced him, and then he sent Batman on, like, a world hunt to find Robin and then played him and said, oh no, but I really want you to marry my daughter. So all of that just felt like a rehash here. And then Oliver being stabbed was, like, a shocking moment or whatever, but it was all for show. And then Ra's never rose above mediocrity. So then Nyssa was sidelined in a lot of the story, and men came before women because, like you said, sexism. And that's just dull. It's just dull. Like, I don't understand the reason why Ra's wanted Oliver to even take over. Like, what was the point?
Right.
Oliver hasn't proved himself in any way.
That's the whole thing. The whole, like, in the comics with him and Batman, like, the whole detective aspect of it is completely missing in the show, because mm-hmm. Oliver didn't detect shit.
Yeah, exactly.
Why is he, you know, why does Ra's respect him so much when Oliver hasn't done anything as far as, like, that kind of worthy strategist mastermind, you know, mm-hmm. rivalry. We didn't see any of that. He's just like, oh yes, you are the greatest. I'm like, really? Other than your daughter, like, your own daughter that you raised and is, like, a competent assassin, but, you know.
Yeah, it was all dumb and lame and boring, and I hated it. But another flop for me was the dragon from last season. So Diaz's arc isn't over yet, unfortunately, but his story and the way his character has been handled was, like, a complete mess. And he's just the most annoying and boring of all the villains, even more boring than they made Ra's in season 3. And they didn't kill him, which is a surprise to me, because he was the villain everyone complained about the most, and yet they keep him around. And then he was just so uninteresting that I'd rather watch NTA and OTA battle each other than have to sit through any minute of DS again.
Aww.
I can't believe he's coming back. Anyway.
Yeah. Moving on to the wild cards, and you can answer both and or either of them, but I think for the series that the wild cards are definitely Deadshot, Floyd Lawton, and Black Siren, who is, you know, Earth 2's Laurel Lance. So for Deadshot is another huge villain in the comics. He is another Batman villain, but he's also, like, part of the Suicide Squad, and so he's a hired assassin. He regularly boasts and he never misses. He uses a large variety of weapons, but most frequently he has these super suppressed wrist-mounted guns that he uses the most often. Initially, his initial appearance, he was initially appeared in Gotham City as a new crime fighter. He tried to overthrow Batman, but Batman and Commissioner Gordon exposed him and sent him to jail for when he became the king of Gotham's underworld. So after he served his term, he starts hiring out his services as an assassin. And it was kind of like crazy because, like, his first appearance, he's in, like, a top hat and tails. Like, he's, like, like he's going to, like, a ball or something fancy. So he's pretty, like, ridiculous initially. But after he goes to jail, it gets a little bit harder. Then he comes out with a new costume, like, third wave, like, no more fancy suits for me. and then he gets, like, the costume that, you know, we all know, like the red jumpsuit with the metal faceplate and all that kind of stuff, and the target on the right side, so Deadshot. And that is Floyd. I guess because it says, like, in his backstory, he grew up in a wealthy household with his mother, an abusive father, and a brother named Eddie. Eddie was loved.
Eddie?
Loved by his parents, yeah. While Floyd was troubled and despised by his parents, so of course he has no issues. Nothing to do with why he became a villain. But Floyd always idolized his brother and stood up for his brother during conflicts with other people, like kids in the town, stuff like that. So it says that Floyd's parents were the most powerful people in the town, but they hated each other. And his mother claimed that his father became too abusive, prompting Floyd to kill his dad. So that's another, like, he's got, like, a pretty deep, disturbing childhood, it seems like. But largely throughout the DC Comics universe, like, I think his biggest impact is in the Suicide Squad. This is what most people know him for. And then on the show, he was originally started when they tried to do the Suicide Squad. That's the reason why we were introduced to him. But people liked him so much that they brought him back, not only on Arrow, but he also made an appearance on The Flash. So that's kind of, like, shows his impact, which I really wish he would go back to Earth 2.
Yes!
Like,
oh, yes!
White and Iris.
Now I feel like I need to watch those episodes.
Yeah. What do you guys think about, I guess, Deadshot first?
Well, I really like Deadshot, and I agree with you that he's one of the more memorable villains of the early seasons of Arrow, and probably all seasons of Arrow, because I can't remember many villains at all.
I think one-off wins for Arrow are harder to pinpoint.
But yeah, and bringing him back in Earth 2 was memorable, obviously. Like, so the Flash obviously liked him, and then didn't he come back again on Arrow? Like, did he die? Did I make that up?
He did quote unquote died, but there was never Bobby, and so then he was magically
okay.
I think he was, like, never in a Bobby. Building that blew up, right?
Yeah, and then I think he quote unquote died again, but there's still no Bobby.
Okay, so as long as there's no Bobby, he can always come back. But yeah, I think it's clear that he's a character that that they really enjoyed, and I think that the audience really enjoyed too, because, like, the audience is often incorporating him into, you know, different, like, headcanons and stuff.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, Deadshot is, like, when you first mentioned him, the first thing that came to my head was the Earth 2 episodes and how, like, they poked fun of his doppelganger being a terrible shot or whatever. And I really like the actor who plays him, whose name escapes me right now. But I think that he really brought something to the role. Like, he has, like, some kind of... He has a charisma, you know? Some charm to him and the way that he plays the character. And I think that Arrow doesn't do very well in terms of, like, one-off villains. Like, they're decent at, you know, season-long villains. But, like, the random villain of the week or some random metahuman showing up is not, like, their thing. So I think that it's a testament to his impact that people enjoyed him so much that he died twice and could continue to pop up at some point.
And then we have Black Siren, which on the show is played by Earth 2 Laurel Lance, and she's a villain on the show, but in the comics she is a superhero, so of the Justice Guild of America, and she's, her real name is Donna Nance. So she's a member of the Justice Guild of America, Black Siren. And there's not, I don't really think, unless you're really into the Justice Guild of America, there's not that much information on her. But what do you think about how Arrow tried to redeem itself by bringing the Canary back to life, but as a villain from another Earth?
I really love Black Siren, even though I feel like, I agree that she's very much a wild card, because, like, first of all, we don't know which way she's gonna, what she's gonna do ever, right? Or what she's gonna bring to the story, how she's gonna react anytime. So, like, in that sense, she's definitely a wild card. And met textually, we did not know that Katie Cassidy was going to come back. Right? Like, they fired Katie Cassidy, basically. They killed her off the show, and then suddenly they were like, just kidding! Yeah, right. Just kidding, we have to bring her back. So, and I mean, like, honestly, like, for a split second, when she first showed up, I can't remember if it was, like, the very end of 509 of Arrow, or if it was, like, the beginning of 510, but either one, like, for a split second, I thought it was, like, Laurel came back to life? Did this happen for real?
It's possible.
So she did fool me for, yeah, it was, it, you know, for a second, I was like, well, Lazarus fits? But anyway, I think it's, like, it's interesting because she just, like, seems to just love, like, destroying things and, like, following trash men around and fulfilling their biddings of destruction. So at first I wasn't all that into her because it's like, okay, we don't know where she's coming from. We don't know why she's doing anything she's doing. But this last season, with the way that Quentin sort of, you know, reached out to her and inspired her to sort of, like, to some degree change her ways. And now we're really going to get to see, like, she's stepping into Laurel's shoes. But at the same time, you know that any wrong gust of wind is going to send her
to some kind of chaotic neutral or something, like.
Yes.
Yeah,
she's definitely not lawful. She's definitely never going to be lawful good. So, yeah. And I enjoy that. I think it's interesting to see some people, because some people really are just out for themselves, you know? And that is really what she's like. It just so happens that Quentin became part of herself. And so now she's doing some better things because of him.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of the reason why she's a wild card is because the writers don't really know if they want to make her purely evil or good. Like, they can't decide, so they just keep flip-flopping back and forth. They're like, we don't want to make someone who looks like Laurel completely bad, so they just have her follow around these guys for whatever reason, even though we don't understand the motives behind the reasons that she follows them. So that sucks, but I think that it's interesting that she can be swayed depending on the motivation. Like, oh, you should be good because your doppelganger was good. So she's like, I'll think about it. And then, you know, if she wants to do bad things because of whatever reason, she'll decide to do it. It's just like, whatever, today I'll become a lawyer. Tomorrow I'll go hurt someone, you know? Who knows what
girls
the future will bring
anything
for Black Siren.
I actually like her. The only thing that I did not like about her arc last season was the whole following Diaz bullshit. Because I just felt like that isn't something, like, there's nothing in it for her to stick with him. I think it was really stupid that a lot of her back and forth in that season was being scared. She's scared of Dinah. She's scared of Diaz. Mm-hmm. I'm like, this is not, no. Like, I didn't really feel like that should have been part of her story, or that she should have been scared of Dinah, that she should have been, you know, because she, unless, I don't know, because even in Earth 2, she was following Hunter Zolomon around.
Yeah.
I do like the fact that you never know what she's going to do or what her motivations are. Like, if she wants to become a lawyer, she'll become a lawyer because that's who she needs to be in order to survive, because everyone already thinks that she's Laurel Lance, so I'm just going to be Laurel Lance. And I like that. I like that she's a little bit unpredictable and she'll do whatever is in her own self-interest. I don't think that Diaz was in her own self-interest, and that's just why I wasn't really compelled by that part of her plot. But yeah. We'll see how which way the wind blows.
Yeah, I think she's ultimately yeah, like a survivor. You know, she just does what she needs to do to live.
Yeah. That's basically it. Like, she's not good. She's not bad. She's just surviving. Like, she's a survivor, so she's gonna do whatever.
She's gonna make it.
Whatever choice she made that Laurel makes it out alive. So that is our Arrow talk, and we'll move in now to the Flash.
The Flash.
Talk about Reverse Flash, Savitar, and Captain Cold and Killer Frost. So four villains. And the first one is the GOAT, the greatest of all time. Reverse Flash, this is not debatable.
Right. The end. Moving on.
That is it. No, I'm just kidding. So in, like, the comics, he's basically, like, the king of petty. found, like, a time capsule, and because he's from the future, so in the 25th century, he found, like, a time capsule of the Flash's costume and a tachyon device that could give him, like, speedster abilities. He starts out as a super fanboy, obsessed with Barry and the Flash and the Flash Museum. I think he actually worked at the Flash Museum, didn't he? for a time?
Yes. Yes. In certain iterations. Yes.
Yeah, of the story. Just obsessed with Barry until he figures out that he is Barry's ultimate villain, the Reverse Flash, which, I don't know, there's some kind of, like, time travel-y, you know, Tamiami stuff that he's like, that's his future, is to be Barry's villain. And he's like the ultimate Stan. Like, Eminem, he wrote the song Stan. Like, he was talking about the card and Barry.
So yes, that's exactly what he's like.
Yeah. And then on the show, I think, you know, especially in season one, when he was, like, the big bad, I think that they really played off of that really well. And the whole, they built up Reverse Flash, and Tom Cavanaugh did a great job as the first face that we associated with Reverse Flash. And then Matt, that I cannot pronounce, is Lesher.
Lesher.
I can't Lecher? Pronounce his last name.
Yeah.
I can't pronounce his last name, but Matt, you know Matt. He came in.
Yeah, you know Matt.
which is kind of, it's kind of like interesting because he had Tom's version of Eobard, which is Eobard not being his full self and pretending to be someone else, but still being him underneath, because he had to pretend to be Harrison Wells. And so, like, Matt had to take that and, like, reveal, take off a layer of Tom's character and become, like, pure Eobard-thon. And I thought he did a really great job, and I can't really go back to Tom as Reverse Flash, not that we have Matt and that Reverse Flash.
There's something about the way that he smiles that's like, just does it for me. I'm just like, yeah, you're just gonna wreck everything.
And I feel like the Flash writers really took their time with building up his career. Like, the only thing that was a little bit weak is that at the end of season one, where Barry finally confronts him, he's like, why? And he's like, because I wanted to. And there's no kind of, like, they built up all season, like, there's gotta be some kind of answer. And he's like, no, there isn't one.
I'm
no! Yeah, so I feel like they could have gone, and they probably will towards the season end. And I think what kind of, like, started me off on this with the Anons is that I think that, you know, because he is the greatest of all time, that they should have put him in, like, little mini arcs in all of the seasons. Yeah. Instead of, you know, just completely, quote-unquote, killing him off, basically, in season one, they could have, you know, had him come back for little mini arcs each season, like they do the crossovers each season. They could have done, like, a little Reverse Flash mini arc. I think he came back, like, once in season two, just for, like, an episode or two, but I feel like they could have consistently keep him in here to remind the audience that we are all leading towards that 2024 byline, which was a fight between Flash and Reverse Flash. So I'd like to continue to see him more because he is such a great villain.
And I think they have the potential to bring him back this, because he's appeared at least once every season. So
right,
I hope that
it's just that it hasn't been like, you know,
yeah,
it
not
hasn't
like in a mini arc way, but
unveiled the more layers of his backstory that we'd like to see.
Right. Yeah, exactly. What do you guys?
I was just gonna say, like, it's impressive, I think, that he did become such an iconic and great villain in season one, despite not including some of those really juicy aspects of his comic story.
I forgot. Like, another part of his comic story is that he's obsessed with Iris and, like, you know, in love with her to the point that he's like, well, because Barry loves her, I'm gonna kill her. And that's some of it that he teased in it. It never really leaned into that whole aspect of Iris versus Eobard, like they did Barry versus Eobard. So that was like
right. Right. But despite not including almost any aspect of his comic book backstory, they did manage to make him a really compelling villain, mostly because, like, time where, like, the pacing actually really worked. Like, the audience is seeing all the ways that Eobard or Harrison Wells is evil, and, well, first shady, right? First shady, and then later straight up evil, without Barry even being aware. So it's not like, why isn't Barry doing anything about this? It's because Barry doesn't even know there's something to do something about. So that's what makes it, that sort of, like, increases the dramatic tension of it all. Plus, we got to see, like, you know, we have a real reason for why Eobard / Harrison Wells can't do all that much yet. Like, a lot of the other major villains were, like, super overpowered early on, right? Like, they can do all this stuff that, like, you kind of feels like, well, obviously there's no way to beat them until episode 23 when suddenly the power of love compels Barry to be fast enough. So, or, you know, someone else does it for him. But this was like with Eobard, it was like, you actually see that, like, something's holding him back, right? He can't, he's not at full capacity right now. And he has to sort of sit around and wait because he can't actually act yet. Because the other aspect too is like, why are these bad guys sending all these random minions when they could just murder Barry in episode one? So yeah, like, he needed Barry to get to a certain place, etc. So, like, it worked out for the most part in season one. Yeah. And that is something that they have not really been able to replicate ever since then. Yeah.
And Seven, they use the best for first, you know?
Oh, my God, after that. Just kidding.
Yeah, yep. It's all downhill from here.
But yeah, I agree. He's absolutely, like, the best villain that the show has ever had. To me, he's kind of like what the Joker is to Batman, and that he's, like, a constant villain in our hero's life and is the complete opposite of what he stands for. So I agree, yeah. Like, season one did a great job building the tension, and then the pacing was really good, and there was, like, this energy that kept going throughout most of the season. And I think he had interesting reasons he didn't want Barry around, and having him be the reason behind so much of what happened to Barry, both in the past and in the present, and maybe in the future too, was really solid. And he also helped introduce time travel to the show, and then Barry's trust issues regarding supposedly good people who walk into Star Labs, and then his suspicions of, like, Hunter as Jay, and then later DeVoe, were all because Reverse Flash scarred him in some way, you know? So that, like, his effects still live on. And him not really dying also means he can just pop up whenever he wants to, so that he always feels like he's lurking in the shadows. So just let him come back, show. Just let him come back and have his own thing.
I feel like I even mentioned, like, the Joker-Batman parallel in one of my answers to the interview, because it's like, you know, Joker is, like, the true, like, chaotic evil to Bruce. Mm-hmm. And I feel like in the same way, Eobard is, like, the true chaotic evil to Barry. Like, he has no other joy in life other than making Barry miserable. And, like, you know, even if it meant, like, the world was burning, if Barry loved that world and Barry was on that world, Eobard was going to let that world burn. Mm-hmm. Like, he's, like, the spite, you know, cut off my nose and spite my face kind of guy.
Yeah, that's why I think it would have been interesting now that you say, like, that he was obsessed with Iris, that him working as Savitar would have made sense.
Well, I mean, even, like, if they had, you know, if they had had some balls and just made Eddie Eobard.
Oh, yeah. Ooh, yeah. There you go.
Would have worked. You know?
That's true.
At that kind of angle. Because I feel like originally, and no matter what, you know, Rick says about whether he was supposed to play Eobard or not, or originally supposed to be Reverse Flash, I think that was where that they were going in the pilot, just with how they wrote Eddie. Yeah. And then with Eddie and Barry being obsessed or fighting over Iris, had that kind of element, and then they just went off in, like, a different direction.
But I also feel like the show definitely forgot that they were related.
Yeah, the season one, and even in his subsequent appearances, they don't really lean into Eobard's chaotic evil as much as I think that they could, because I feel like that's the part that's the most, like, compelling about him, is that he's just, like, batshit, I don't really care as long as Barry suffers kind of thing. And I think they show that a little bit, but they don't really kind of lean into that, because that's kind of, like, the crazy that makes him such a good villain. Mm-hmm. Moving on to our next villain, which is, I think I've said, Savitar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't really know, like, I ultimately put Savitar as my underdog, just because I felt like there was a story there that they didn't follow through on again. So, it's like, you know, not following through. But he's completely different from the comics backstory. Just one of the fact that he's not a Hindu godspeed and the cult aspect of it. And he's also Wally's villain. So this is Wally's villain that they made Barry's villain and then made Barry. So it's like layers and layers and layers of things. And I feel like I think I talked about this again in one of my asks, but they should have just made Savitar Cobalt Blue. Because that's basically what the story was anyway. that this clone Barry was wanted, like, jealous
Barry's life.
Of actual Barry's life, and it's like, well, I'm just gonna kill actual Barry, or make actual Barry miserable, but and then he kind of went off, you know, by killing Iris, because they wrote themselves in a hole with the whole time travel and all that kind of stuff. But that Cobalt Blue would have been perfect for that. It would have saved, like, a actual villain and kept his ethnicity. Because it made, it, like, Barry as Savitar just seems, makes Barry seem like an ass. Like, it's about time. I'm going to become a Hindu. Got to speed. You know, it just makes Barry seem ridiculous to call himself Savitar. But Cobalt Blue in the comics, Nora Allen originally had twins, but and she was in the hospital the same time as the Thawns. The Thawns lost their child. Nora had twins, so and the doctor, I think Thawns lost their child because of the doctor's error, and the doctor didn't want to like own up to the error, so he just like stole one of Nora's babies and gave it to the Thawns, and that became Malcolm Thawne. And then when Malcolm found out that he and Barry were twins, and that kind of like kicked all that off, and and he inherited Cobalt Blue from the Thawne family. So basically, it's the same kind of thing where it's like twins, one's evil and one's good, and like that is Savitar. So I wish they had just like done that, and then maybe instead of like trying to kill Iris, that, you know, I think that even if they did go down that route, I think that Iris should have had more of a say in Savitar's storyline than she did, because of the whole reason that he exists in the first place is because Barry being depressed of not having Iris's love, and the whole concept of Savitar is a Barry that has never experienced Iris's love, then Iris's love should have been what saved him, and not like shared memories of ice cream on a dock that Savitar never actually experienced. Like, that didn't make sense to me. Like, I thought that was lame. But as potential, I think that it was, he's probably the underdog for me. But what did you guys think?
I agree. I mean, I think Savitar did have his scary moments, and like the personal vendetta he had against Barry had a lot of potential. And I loved the whole I am my own greatest enemy aspect of it. And if they'd done it a bit differently and better, it could have been really good. But then the pacing in the back half of the season, the confusion, like you said, about the time travel and time remnant stuff, which still confuses me to this day, and how they handled like the lack of overall activeness of not just Iris but just like the general team in trying to figure out who he was until almost the end of the season put a damper on the whole thing. And then not only that, but the fact that it was revealed that Savitar was someone, was Barry, and then Barry used Savitar's name, like you said, was super weird because the role should have gone to someone of Indian ethnicity, or they could have given him another name. Like you said, Cobalt Blue, make him Cobalt Blue. That would have made sense. So he was like the darkest villain of the show because of the stakes and the fact that it involved Iris constantly being murdered every week,
right,
which was super unpleasant. But it was just like an overall fail in the lack of potential that they could have had. And then Grant did sell Savitar's emotions. Like, we saw his anger, then we saw him being jealous of himself, and then he was vulnerable for and almost made to be sympathetic in the 2.5 seconds that Iris touched his face.
Which is why she should have been like, they should have had that conversation like sooner. Like, if they had revealed him by episode 15 and, you know, also had him, because it also made no sense why he didn't even want to like go up and talk to Iris or confront Iris or like even taunt Iris until the finale when he had to like collect her to stab her. Mm-hmm. You know, that didn't really make any sense to me either, so.
Because the writers were afraid that if he interacted with Iris, he would go back on and be like, yeah, no, maybe this is a bad idea.
Well, I mean, that would have been the point. Instead of like killing her, let me just take her for myself.
No, I think it was the character who was afraid of that, you know, rather than the writers who were afraid of that. But yeah, I agree that Savitar is the underdog, and the waste of potential of him hurts my feelings. And yes, I agree that he should not have been called Savitar. Should have called him Cobalt Blue or anything else. It doesn't matter. And be done with it. But, like, for me, it's kind of a toss-up between Zoom and Savitar for, like, who I would choose for the underdog. Because they are both, you know, mysterious, crazy, blue lightning speedsters whose reveals wound up being much more disappointing than their buildup was, just because I think that it was so much more personal, and there was a lot of potential for an interesting story there, and, like, there was months of speculation from the fans on, like, not beyond just, like, oh, who is Savitar? Like, all these reasons for why Savitar would be Barry, and they really, like, one thing they did do was lay it on thick the whole season with the hints of Barry being his own worst enemy. You know, like, it was very clear that Savitar was Barry, and yet people were still, you know, like, oh my god, I can't believe it. So that was a good balance. It's just that, like you already mentioned, the pacing of the back half really brought it down, plus the fact that they weren't clear on their own causal time loop. And there was a way to make it very crystal clear and easy to work with, but they did not take that way, and thus they wrote themselves in a hole, and they didn't know how to get out of it, and then the audience didn't understand what a causal time loop is, even though Sisko explained it in the first season. But that's okay. That's all the writers. So, and also Grant Gustin was a great villain for the 10 seconds he was allowed to be one. So yeah, I really liked the concept and the idea of Savitar, and then it's just so the execution kind of, you know, fell flat along the way. They should have taken, like, if they had taken out, like, 4 episodes from season 3, it might have been better. But yeah. I mean, also, I also prefer, like, when you're going to, like he wanted to destroy the Flash pretty much, right? Mm-hmm. And then take over for himself. And that's a more believable thing. Like, especially because the way he's doing it is by killing Iris. So then, you know, Barry would just be useless after that. Like, it's like, I believe that could happen. As opposed to, like, I'm going to destroy the multiverse, and then I'm going to rule the ashes or whatever, like every other villain. So, there you go.
Yeah, yeah. It just goes back to making Barry just, like, seem like a ridiculous kind of person.
Yeah.
Wild cards. Captain Cold is my wild card for the series as a whole, because, I think, hands down, Wentworth Miller's performance just made him, like, the most, like, iconic. And I'm sure, like, his first appearance, him and Dominic Purcell, it was supposed to be just, like, a fun one-episode iconic villain of the week episode, and then just turned into a whole-ass other show.
Right.
For, you know, both of those characters. But definitely Wentworth and his portrayal as Leonard Snart is what kind of sold the whole thing. Still in the comics, there are whole, like, aspects of his character that just didn't make it over to the show. And a big one is that he is also obsessed with Iris and wants to be with Iris. And
Iris
having none of it. But his, you know, they kept the whole, like, his fictional character biography. Abusive father, so they kept that, and he took refuge with his grandfather, who worked in an ice truck, and that's how you don't get the whole Captain Cold. Also, I think, I'm pretty sure in the comics, he's a metahuman, and he's not on the show.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how he turned out to be a metahuman, or if that's, you know, if that's a comics thing, or if that's just, because I know he is in the animated universe, but I think he's also in the comics, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, wait. What's the question?
Yeah, he's a metahuman in the comics, but not on the
show. He's not a metahuman in the comics. He just has the gun. Yeah.
I feel like somewhere, he was a meta. And I'm not sure if it was just, like, an animated universe, or maybe I'm confusing with like, Freeze. But usually, like, when you see him and the DC animated universe, they usually group, like, all Cold villains together. So you've got Killer Frost, Freeze, and Captain Cold usually, like, doing some kind of Cold shit on, I know that one for sure happened in, like, Young Justice. But on the show, I think initially in his first appearance, people thought that it was just, like, really, like, campy, but that worked for the show, and, like, he kept coming back, and, you know, he's another one that lived long enough as a villain to turn into a frenemy with his relationship with Barry. And I liked that in season 1, the whole Speed and Cold are opposites thing is a Cold Flash saying, And it does not mean that they naturally attract. Speed and opposites doesn't mean that they have sexual tension, you know, Barry Caitlin fans. It means that their, like, ideologies are the opposite. Mm-hmm. So, like, Barry is Speed, obviously, and the way that he thinks about the law, like, what's good versus what's bad, and is completely opposed to Leonard's viewpoints of good, bad morality and all that kind of stuff. So that's that kind of ideology. I really like that dynamic between them. But I also just wish that it wasn't only Barry and Leonard interacting, because that's like season one was the whole like Barry's the center of the universe, so that was a little bit whatever. But what did you guys think about Captain Cold and his impact on the Flash?
Well, I think that he is awesome and definitely the wild card. Like, he's an iconic Flash villain in the comics, and it's one that, you know, the show made iconic in its own way, or that Wentworth really, Will Miller really made iconic in his own way. Because, like, there's plenty of famous Flash villains in the comics that come on the show and then kind of disappear without really a second thought, mm-hmm. you know? But people have been sort of, you know, talking about Leonard Snart, talking about Captain Cold ever since his first appearance, right? Like, he's not just, like, been back to the Flash probably more times than any other villain who's not Reverse Flash. But he also then became the most memorable part of Legends Season 1. Yeah. And probably the only universally loved part of last year's crossover. Everyone can agree that Leo Snart was
the best.
Excellent, yes. So, I mean, I think it's because, like, yes, it's, like, a cold-hearted villain or just, like, a kind of, like, chaotic, you know, he just does whatever he wants for himself, but he also has a lot of charisma. He's got, like, Wentworth's got a lot of charm. He's obviously got those great, like, one-liners and puns. But you also see the loyalty he has to his, to first Heatwave and then to his sister, you know? And then, like, as his appearances go on, it sort of, like, gets extended. Like when he respects you, he then treats you in a certain way, so now he respects Barry, right? So we get to see the kind of, like, interesting, like you said, like, a villain that lives long enough to become a frenemy, right? That kind of thing. Like, he didn't even have to, it didn't even take that long for him to become a frenemy. They really wanted to get there quickly because they love him that much. And yeah, so, like, and we've seen the impact that he's had because, like, I don't think there's any other villain in the Arrowverse who has inspired as much shipping as Leonard, you know? As much fanfics, fan art, whatever, all kinds of fan works dedicated to Leonard Snart.
Yeah. Also in the comics, Captain Cold is, like, the leader of the Flash's rogues gallery. So he's also, like, one of, like, the big, like, strategic mind. His, all of his skills and experience in planning, which also kind of carries over into the show, even though he didn't get to lead the rogues gallery. They made a whole, like, to-do about that in season one, but we never... Mm-hmm. What, I guess at the end of season one, they had one kind of, like, mini-villain team-up, but... Mm-hmm. You get the same kind of, like, character traits of him being, like, a strategic thinker kind of carried over into the show with Wentworth's portrayal of Wynn.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think they got really lucky with casting Wentworth Miller because just the way that he says his lines, like, anybody could have said, like, make a plan, execute the plan, and just made it sound super boring or something, but he had a way to, like, make it memorable, and it's now, like, super quotable. And I think he had an intriguing relationship with Barry, and even his nicer non-villainous doppelganger could get through to him in the fourth season, so that was nice. And he's like that type of character who can just pop up and leave you always wanting more of him, but he never overstays his welcome, which is nice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I agree, he does have charisma in his
always own... leaves you wanting more.
Yes. And he has, like, his own weird moral code that he abides by, so his presence is always welcome.
Unfortunately, the same cannot be said for our next cold villain, Killer Frost. She's a flop on the show, and not for, you know, several reasons that I'm sure many people would like to point out, but just in the sense that they have just totally mishandled any kind of backstory that would have made her compelling. And part of that is just because they dragged it out so long that she wasn't even a meta. But in the comics, she's got, there's three iterations of Killer Frost. So you have Crystal Frost, who was the original, I believe, and then Louise Lincoln, and then Caitlin Snow. And usually it is, and she's got kind of a She's always like a, you know, like a bioengineer, and she is kind of like a, it's kind of a sad, dark kind of backstory, because the original one, Crystal Frost, she was studying to be a scientist and fell in love with Martin Stein. So she, the connection between Caitlin and Martin Stein on the show, I don't know if that's like an Easter egg to the connection between Frost and Stein in the comics.
They are close.
They're very close. It, obviously, it's not romantic, but I don't know if that is like born out of Victor and Danielle's chemistry together, or if there is some kind of like tied back to, you know, the origin story of Crystal Frost. But in the comics, Stein didn't really reciprocate her feelings, and she kind of spiraled, I think, and accidentally locked herself in like a thermofrost chamber, but survived and transformed into to Killer Frost. And then Louise Lincoln, I think, was a colleague of Crystal's, and so she, after Crystal died, she decided to repeat the experiment and became the second Killer Frost. And then you have Caitlin Snow, who is the newest one. I'm not really sure how, if her, I think her origin story is similar to Crystal's, except that it's Hive agents. She was working on a lab outpost for Star Labs in the Arctic, and it was infiltrated by the Hive, and they tried to kill her by locking her inside the engine, and she like rips off like the coolant system, and that kind of like initiates her change into down towards Killer Frost or whatever. And I can't remember if they're all heat vampires or specifically one of the three, but that was part of like her comics. Like she wasn't necessarily evil, but she had to kill people to get them warmth, because she's just like constantly cold all the time, so she needed that heat. And that's also why she kind of like linked up with Firestorm, because he's like, you know, forever heat. And kind of balances out that way. And they didn't, I don't even know what they're trying to do for her in the show, because it didn't really seem like they had a direction or that they wanted to do it at all for a long time.
And that's why she's a flop.
That's basically it. Because I feel like season one, there are so many times where it could have been hinted or given like a legit reason why she would want to turn evil. Because it's fine that she starts out as like a kind of cold, you know, shell, hard shell on the outside, but ultimately, like, when you really, like, get past that, then she's very warm with her friends. And why would she ever turn on Barry? Well, Barry, whether it was intentionally or not, is the reason that her husband died, and she was the one that was most unwilling to turn against Harrison Wells, so you have that kind of, like, she's already siding with the villain, secretly. That she, you know, she's not aware of it, but secretly she's already leaning towards the villainous path. And I feel like that could have been the start to maybe her kind of exploring her dark side, and it just never happened. And then they even went further and said that she's not a metahuman. And then, you know, well, maybe she is a metahuman because Barry changed the timeline. And then, well, maybe she's always been a metahuman. And so it's kind of like, what story are you doing? Like, you can't just keep like reinventing the wheel over and over again, because I don't care anymore.
Right. This is it, guys. I feel the same that you feel. I feel your feels. And I think she started with some promise. Like, I think like when they first, like, I don't know what it was, like that, like she was like in the shower and like her hair came off and it turned white or whatever. And I was like, oh, this is cool. Like, it's going to go somewhere cool. But it did not go somewhere cool, not even in a punny way. Instead it just quickly became another way to rob a woman of her agency. Like, she didn't choose to go dark or to become evil or to do evil, hurtful things because of her circumstances or because of the allure of her powers, or even, like in the comics, the fact that she needs heat to survive. Instead, it was just like she has no control over her split personality or other, like, entity that is possessing her body, and then just decides to hurt people because it feels like it. You know? And then, of course, even though she's just, like, a mad woman who just does whatever she wants and hurts people for no reason, any time that Barry, Sisko, or Iris say, like, enough pacifying words, she's like, okay, I guess I'll be Caitlin now. So there's no rhyme or reason to it. And it's like the worst parts of Rain and Black Siren combined into one character with not any of their good parts. Except for, you know, sometimes she gets fun lines. Sometimes she has cool costumes. Sometimes she makes a little, like, ice slide or ice broom or whatever it is. And those are cool. But otherwise, she lacks motivation, direction, and logic, and is therefore uninteresting to me.
And she like, literally flops because she doesn't last in any kind of, like, physical fight situation for longer than a couple seconds. So, like, that's another thing. Like, she's supposed to be a very, like, powerful metahuman in the comics, and yet, you know, a gust of wind will knock her out on the show.
I think the only time Killer Frost has made sense to me was on Earth 2. And I think they made a mistake in trying... Well, I'll get to that. So Killer Frost, for me, is one of the show's biggest missed opportunities, because it's like the reluctance to just admit that maybe Caitlin isn't as wholesome as she was initially made out to be that puts a wrench in the whole entire thing. Like, they don't want to have her make her own decisions, so they gave her a split personality, and then they've rebooted the origin of the character so many times that it's become confusing and hard to keep track of. And then having Killer Frost be the way she is because she needs heat and doesn't have it makes a lot of sense, but the writers clearly don't want to go that route, nor have they ever seemed to want to go that route. And I think it's even worse... Go ahead.
Since it, as, like, in the show with Caitlin being, like, not being evil, like, that would have been, like, the most logical, practical way for her to... Evil without actually being evil.
Exactly. It's like, it's okay for her to not always be nice. Like, she can have feelings. And I think it's even worse because the way that they've done it makes Caitlin look wishy-washy as a character, and that's a shame because, like, having her take control over her own actions and powers would have been far more compelling to watch. But, like, as it stands now and the way they've done it, the lack of responsibility over anything she does, and then the constant back and forth for the character's motivations and reasoning makes it really difficult to take her seriously as a villain because she's not around long enough and they're more focused on, like, just rebooting her and not giving her anything else to do. And I can't take that seriously as Killer Frost and now as Caitlin. Like, what is going on? Just tell me.
Yeah. Okay, so I think we wrapped up on Killer Frost. So the next show we're talking about is Legends of Tomorrow. They have the fewest overall big bad villains, so we don't have a lot to go through. But we have Vandal Savage, the Legion of Doom as a group unit, so not all of them individually. And then Malice, just because he was the last one. So first up, Vandal Savage, obviously the floppiest to flop. ever. And it's like when you look at his repertoire in the comics and in the DC animated universe, and then you see what they did with him on Legends of Tomorrow, it's just like criminal. They should not be allowed to write superhero shows anymore, kind of. But Vandal Savage started, like, in the comics, he started out as a caveman, so he's basically like one of the first people, you know, of civilization, and he's, like, bathed in the radiation of this mysterious, like, meteorite storm, and gave him, like, incredible intellect and immortality, and he's lived through hundreds of civilizations under different names. He's had a hand in, according to him, and a lot of different things, like he was Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, Genghis Khan, Jack the Ripper during the Victorian era. Like, he was playing, like, all of these different, like, people. So, like, the greatest villains of all time were Vandal Savage in the comics. And then under the, like, I knew him, I think, mostly from, like, Young Justice. Like, he had a huge presence. And I feel like it was season two, whenever, like, the light became, like, a big thing.
Yeah.
And he was, like, the founder of the light or one of the leaders of that, like, group. So he had, like, a huge, wide-ranging presence in the comics. But then in the show, they just made him to be, like, an ancient Egyptian priest, jealous lover, or, like, wannabe lover between Hawk Girl and Hawkman, and they're connected to them through time. It just kind of just really made him seem super pathetic in his motivations of, like, what he was trying to do. And, you know, I didn't even watch this season, and I can tell you how pathetic he was, but I'll send it over to you guys.
I love how you didn't watch, like, half of the show's first season.
Only two. But what did you guys think of Vandal Savage on Legends of Tomorrow?
Well, the floppiest flop is about correct for him. I think that the biggest issue, aside from, you know, changing so much about his backstory, is also tying him to the Hawks, because they didn't develop the Hawks enough for us to root for them in opposition to him, or, like, actually actively care about him sort of tearing them down or tearing them apart. Because, again, like, when you've got, like, oh, world destruction is my goal. No one, the world's not going to get destroyed, so I'm not concerned about this. Unless you're watching, spoiler alert, Cabin in the Woods, and then maybe the world gets destroyed. But most of the time, if you're watching a TV show, the world's not getting destroyed, so you need to have a connection. Either, like, you have to find the villain compelling, which he was not. The acting was, you know, he couldn't really rise above the material. The material was, I am obsessed with Hot Girl, and I really want to possess her. Which, you know, it's 2016, let's move on from owning women. So, like, it was really boring to watch those three characters go in some kind of merry-around, because they were, like, the worst parts of the season. And also, like, the show, like, he just doesn't fit the tone of the show. Like, the show was a bunch of, like, wacky characters doing wacky things, and then there's Vandal Savage, who seems like he's super serious business, and it just doesn't make sense. It's very confusing.
His motivation didn't make sense either, because, like you said, like, he's bent on, like, world destruction, but in the comics, like, his main motivator is, like, the kind of Darwinism, like, the acceleration of humankind, not to its, like, ultimate destruction, but that it could be, like, humanity is, like, future rulers of the universe. So that even doesn't make sense that he would be, like, world destruction!
Yeah, like, they oversimplified his reasoning behind everything, and I think making him the villain, like, he was so campy, but, like, in a bad way, which is strange for this kind of show. He was just, like, watching him was just difficult to sit through, because it's hard to watch him deliver his lines and not want to roll your eyes. And then also pairing him with the Hawks, like Tati already said, it was just bad, because the Hawks were just, you didn't want to have them get together. They had a terrible relationship. No one cared. And then having Vandal Savage want Hog Girl as well, and you're just like, why? but his motivations, and then at one point he has a kid in the future that he raised to help also take over the world. It was really bizarre, and it made no sense, and then everyone was happy when they left. It just didn't work.
Yeah.
And thankfully they realized that.
Well, of course, not everyone was happy. There are still people who are fans of a Hot Girl, so, you
okay,
know.
That's
you're
okay.
Valid,
I'm
too.
Sorry.
That one fan matters.
Anyway. Fan lives matter.
Anyway, moving on. The Legion of Doom, I think, you know, considering the short series that Legends has compared to other shows, this is their greatest all-time group. And that's the reason why I started in season 2, because it was better. I feel like this is the big bad that was the most, like, well-developed, most compelling, because they brought in big personality villains, and watching the villains kind of, like, bicker with each other as much as they fought against the actual heroes was, you know, it matched up with, like you guys said, the tone of the show and the, you know, heroes and their infighting and bickering and kind of, like, you know, being fuck-ups was also, like, paralleled with that on, like, the evil side. So it kind of been matched up really well. There's not a lot that I saw from the comics other than the fact that the Legion of Doom is the superhero polar opposite of the Super Friends. So you've got Super Friends and you have Legion of Doom. There's, like, 13 members of the Legion of Doom, and none of them are on the show. I feel like also the Legion Legion didn't really do much to kind of improve Merlin's, my feelings about Merlin. And
yeah, I mean, he's been there for so long.
But they did help to improve my feelings about Damian Dark.
I think Damian Dark kind of came out probably more so in season three for me. Mm-hmm. But I just think overall, those three as like bickering villains with all of them have their egos. All of them want to like claim to be the leader of this one group, and they're trying to like work together. Just really worked very well for that show. And I'm sad that it kind of imploded at the end with all of them either dying or going away. So, what do you guys?
It's definitely the GOAT. And I also, like, for me, I think that it's amazing that they turned two flop Arrow villains into, like, the Captain Planet of Arrowverse villains together. And also, like, because the thing was, like, with three of them, it's fun to watch them play off each other. Is it three of them? Is it four? Is three, right?
Doesn't matter. It was three, and then they added Lynn at the end.
Okay. Man, like, we get to see them play off each other, and their plan actually has, like, some sense of direction and, like, some sense of, like, I don't know, crescendo, right? There's, instead of just being like, well, here we go, for 16 episodes, we're gonna kill everybody. And it suited the tone of the show, right? Like, their bickering, like, reduces them to kind of be, like, the same kind of, like, wacky opposite of the Wave Rider, which is fun to see. It makes it more enjoyable. And because it worked, I think that, like, I'm with you that obviously Damian was even better in season three than he was in season two, but it was, like, I was willing to, like, wait for him to become better, right? Because it took him a little while to get with the dynamic with Nora, because there was, like, some goodwill left over from the Doom, Leader Doom in season two.
Yeah, I think it made sense that they were on the show, especially with the whole time travel thing and why the Legends were trying to battle them, because you had an actual time traveler in the group. So all of that stuff that was happening made sense, besides like just using anachronisms, for example, to get the Legends to do things. It was an actual villain who could mess with time. And then having these three guys, like you guys said, like bicker, and they were also over the top and just doing the most all the time. Was just super fun to watch. And then also centering Reverse Flash in the fact that he wants to ultimately save himself from all of this stuff. And it made for, like, just very intriguing and I think worthy opponents of the Legends versus, like, everybody else who they also seemed like active participants in trying to take down the villains as well. So they made the Legends look good. So I think as a group, I think maybe in the future they should actually think about pairing up villains together to make it more worthwhile.
We'll move on to the third and final, well, he's the second flop of this group, the third and final villain of Legends, Malice. I think he's gotta be an original character, because I couldn't find anything on him. The closest that came to finding something was, like, this character called the Time Trapper, super kind of obscured, I feel like. His main enemies are legions of superheroes. He's kind of, you know, he's always depicted. He looks kind of like a Grim Reaper in that he has, like, you know, the hood and, like, the what's that thing that you turn, you keep time, it's like a time turner, whatever. The hourglass is what it is.
Yes.
Oh, an hourglass.
I was going to say, we know what you're talking about, burner. Even though the
All right, never mind.
I'm talking about Days of Our Lives here. Sam acting. And he's, you know, his lair is located at the end of time. And so, like, a lot of his powers are involved around, like, manipulating future time and creating, like, pocket dimensions and stuff like that. So that's kind of Malice Thieves. And that's the closest that I could get to finding something about him in the comics. But in the show, he's just kind of a hot mess of, they didn't really know what to do with him and what he was going to represent, I feel like. And it's kind of disappointing in a way to go from the Legion of Doom to Malice. And I think part of that is because you never really saw him for, like, much of it. And I feel like they tried to imitate the Legion of Doom by giving Malice these his agents, mm-hmm. of Doom, if he will, with Kuasa, Nora, and Damien again. But Damien's kind of, like, outsold Malice. And then he was defeated by Bebo. Like, who, like, what kind of supervillain gets defeated by a Bebo? Like, you can't, you lost all of your supervillain cred.
I was going to say, probably the best thing that maybe many people can agree on is the best thing to come from Malice was Bebo.
Bebo, yeah. So, yeah, he's a flop for me, for sure. Yeah.
You are not wrong. I thought that we were, like, it's like one of everyone had to be like a different thing, but there isn't a different thing for Malice to be because he's definitely not a wild card. And I mean, I guess he could be an underdog if it was like, if only he were good, it would be better.
It's not even interesting though.
Exactly. So like, there's nothing about him. So think, but like, he's slightly better than Vandal Savage because Damien and Nora were interesting and we cared about them. So it's like, he was a flap, but at least we got some good father daughter scenes out of his existence. And Bebo. Like you said, we also got Bebo, so really, wasn't that bad. No, but yeah, like, I don't know what it is that Legends doesn't really seem to have, like, a firm grasp on their villains. Maybe because it's just, it's, like, too amorphous, like, I don't know. Like, they're just going through time, like, chilling, so they would rather not have a villain at all. So they're just kind of like, here's a villain, whatever. But yeah, like, the only interesting thing about him was that when he was going to possess Nora, and then, you know, Damien was gonna, you know, save his daughter. So, like, that was interesting, but nothing that Malice has ever done or said, even, like, being John Noble was not interesting. So.
Right. And it, that John Noble, being John Noble should have made it more interesting, and it just was not. And because you didn't even see John Noble.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yep.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, I took him less seriously because by the time he appeared, it was just this big creature thing. And mm-hmm. I don't know what to make of that.
Yeah. I don't even see why they bother with big bads because, you know, they've been doing well just with their villain of the week. It's kind of like, you know, procedural cop drama.
Yeah, stuff. We don't even need one.
Yeah.
You don't need a big bad.
I agree. Plus, like, I feel like a season-long big bad attempts to make the Legends more heroic than they admittedly might be. And I think it's okay for them to have just a weekly run-in with some rando while they're time-traveling to another place and then just fix it in that one episode and move on. Like, I wouldn't mind that at all. So, if they want to dump the season-long big bad, I'm okay.
Any other Malice thoughts from me?
No. I just like that they use Malice to bring in, what's her face?
Kuasa?
Kuasa, thank you, and brain dead this morning. And then didn't really use her much, like, if at all. And they tied that back to all the time travel stuff and should I go back to my village and whatnot, and it just didn't work. But that, I guess that's not to blame on the villain himself because he wasn't really around.
Malice is such a flop that we have to, like, resort to the villains that he was working with and talk about them.
Yeah, exactly. He also flopped because he failed the people who were working for him, so.
Aww. He flops on all levels.
Yes, exactly. He was just underwhelming and blah. Like, I forgot he was around half the time. He just didn't exist until, like, that final scene.
Basically. So moving on to our next show, Black Lightning. All of the villains in this show are kind of interconnected. But Tobias Well, Lady Eve, and the ASA as, like, a secret shadow organization. I know when we first found out about Black Lightning, Tati gave us the lowdown on Tobias Well and that whole thing. From what is in his character bio, he's an African-American albino kingpin who worked his way up from the rackets. We know that there is an issue between Tobias and Jeff because Tobias Well killed Jefferson's father. And I feel like the show seems to be, and Tati can correct me if I'm wrong, but the show seems to be following pretty closely to their comic backstory and relationship between him and Tobias. Mm-hmm. And he's like, Marvin Condon is like really great in this role. I think he's got and even as like a new actor, I can tell there's some little bits where I can kind of see the acting, but as the episodes,
and you're like, you're new here.
Yeah, he definitely kind of like found his groove in Tobias and like who Tobias is, and I think Tobias himself is such an intricate, compelling, deep, in-depth, drawn-out character that he is almost as interesting to watch as the heroes, as Jefferson is. And when he's gone, because he was gone for like 2 or 3 episodes, like you could feel that presence. Like, where the fuck is Tobias? Mm-hmm. I want to know what he's up to. And that's, you know, something that you want from your villains. It's like, that's how you know you have a good villain. People like miss him. There's like his presence is missed when he's not there. And hopefully in the next season, he'll come up more since now he's gotten some of his, what do you call it? So when he's on like the ladder to stepping up into his like kingpin-ness, like the people around him, he's like pushed them off the ladder. So now he's like got his free way up to the top. So hopefully that'll come more. We'll see more of him and more of how he would run things without being, you know, having to like go up to a supervisor and ask for permission and stuff like that. So what do you guys think about Tobias?
I love Tobias. And I think what's great is that Black Lightning really sort of understands that slow and steady wins the race when it comes to like villain stories, right? I like that they didn't go with a villain origin story for him. So we're not waiting for seasons for him to become bad while dealing with Lamo major arcs. Like he's already the big bad, but we're slowly piecing out the origin story, right? We're getting where he came from. We're getting where the enmity between him and Black Lightning came from, as we're already in the midst of it, which I think is interesting. And I also like that, you know, like you said, Krondon's doing a great job, and he knows, or he just like instinctively knows how to make Tobias more compelling, or even like we can empathize with him, even though he's doing like wild things, and obviously we don't like him, but we see why it's happening, which I think is great. I always like the, you know, explain but don't excuse, right? I think he's right in that great area. Yeah. It's not in the part where you're like, oh, he's not even the bad guy. I just love him and he should win or whatever, which some people fall into. But it's also not like, why is this guy can just die now? So it's neither of those.
Yeah, I think those are the best types of villains. Like you said, explain and not excuse, because otherwise you're just like, is he a villain if he's still like doing all these things? But I sympathize so much with him that I don't think he's in that category. But I think Tobias has this great presence. Like when he's on screen, you just know something's about to go down, or like the way that he speaks to people, he knows that he is powerful and he knows what he wants. He has a plan, and he also has insecurities, and you see that as well with regards to all the like his backstory and all the magic talk and things like that. And then it's almost like a personal vendetta with Jefferson, and also something bigger that he's stirring up, which is awesome. And every week is just so great to watch him tangle with whoever he happens to be in the same room with. And there's just something terrifying about him whenever he's around. And I think that you nailed it when you said that, when you said, Jess, that when he's gone, it's noticeable that he's gone. Like, we wanted him back because that he is the story. He is the villain story. Everybody else is just kind of there.
Yeah. And the other one that really, I think, left a huge impression was, and I called this the wild card pick for me, Lady Eve. Because one, Jill Scott, and two, I wasn't expecting her when we saw her to have the arc and the influence that she had while she was on the show. And a lot of, I can't even say like a lot of it had to do with Jill Scott, because Jill Scott was like amazing on her own, but then also like the writing and the character of Lady Eve was also just really compelling and interesting to watch, especially her back and forth between her and Tobias, and like her whole like she's a very Southern woman, and the whole like very nice facade, very pleasant, but very cutthroat underneath, but that like backhand compliments and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I loved watching her. And it's like, I was looking up her backstory, and she is an outsider's villain. Like, she's appeared with, like, Batman and also in The Outsiders, so this would be more of a tie-in to Thunder. But it was kind of interesting, because when I looked it up, and this is Lady Eve, the New Earth Lady Eve, but she's, like, a white lady, and she's got, like, she's, like, a, she's quote-unquote Egyptian, but she's basically a white lady. in the comic, she's a member of, like, the Cobra cult. She joins Cobra on his secret plan to, like, mind control high officials of the U.S. Army and steal, like, satellite defense programs and blackmail the U.S. government, basically. She first met Cobra in Egypt when she nursed him back to health with her tribe, which she's, like, she's a white lady, so what is she doing in Egypt with
right.
the tribe? But, yeah, she's that's kind of her, like, style. She's and it's very... It's very, like, stereotypical, like, Cobra outfit, very, like, sexy, revealing, you know, Egyptian-looking style, like, costume or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, for them to take this kind of shell named Lady Eve and remake her into the show with Jill Scott and her running, like, a funeral home, and you can, they still have, like, the element of mysticism in ancient Egypt with her talking about, like, the albino bones and, you know, voodoo and all this kind of stuff. So, all like, I feel like they did a really nice job making Lady Eve relevant to the tone of the show. Just, I think she was a really good TV adaptation, and I'm just a little bit salty, or a lot of it salty, that she died.
Yeah. I'm still waiting for her to, like, you know, come back to life. Like, yeah, use the powers on her. Use the resurrection on her, please.
Like, you know, Mama.
Yeah, so that's why I'm still, like, I'm still rooting for her, you know, in a wild card fashion to come back for season two. But, yes, she was, like a big, bold villain that also had, like, a lot of nuance. It was great to watch her, like, put the fear of God into Bias, right? Because he's already so scary that someone there's someone who can kind of control him to some degree, which is very yeah. impressive. But yeah, she exemplified speaking softly while carrying a big stick. And I miss her. And I want her back.
Yeah, I feel the
and
same.
And she can bring Tori back with her.
Yeah, I mean, she... I can't believe they got rid of her. Like, when she died, I was so surprised. And I was like, this must be a joke, right? Because she's just that kind of villain. Like, I don't feel like we even scratched the surface of who she was and what she could do. And I think she disappeared far too soon. So maybe there's hope that she can come back. But Jill Scott's presence was just amazing. Like, I loved watching her on screen. And even in her scenes with Gambi, I'm like, oh, she knows Gambi and all of these things. And there's just, like, so much... I feel like there were so many layers to her that we only saw some of that, and she knew what she was doing. She had everyone in their place, you know, and it was just, there was just something terrifying about her, but she didn't have to, like, speak. I remember she, like, she was cutting something in one scene and she was just, like, staring, and I'm like, this is,
she has presence.
Yes, she has massive presence, and I love that about her. So it was just really shocking and unfortunate that she had to die so soon.
And then lastly, from Black Lightning, we have the ASA as, like, a secret organization. They're kind of, like, the skeleton of the whole supervillain, like, body for season one. And it's unfortunate that they flopped on that. I feel like they added an element that wasn't really needed. And I don't think... I don't know if it's... Maybe it's in the Black Lightning comics. I don't know. But... because I couldn't really find anything in the ASA as, like, a organization throughout the DC Comics universe. But they just didn't need it. They really didn't need to add... I can't remember what his name is, but the white guy that's always playing, like, a racist somebody.
I can't remember his name.
On Scandal, he was also played, like, this racist, like, senator.
Oh, that's know. Right. That yeah. is him.
That's, he's typecasted in those kind of roles. So I don't know if that's good or bad for him. I guess he said he's making money as a racist white guy, but I didn't really need him on the show, I felt like he was a little bit out of place, and I feel like they tried to use him to make up for the fact that Tobias wasn't there, but because Tobias is such, like, a big presence, you know, the ASA just could not, like, fill up that space that he left when he wasn't on the screen. And then it's also, like, it was a little bit corny and a little bit, like, too on the nose with the whole Make America Great Again and all this other bullshit. Mm-hmm. I cannot for the life of me figure out why, or it just did not make sense to me why someone like Tobias, someone like Lady Eve, had this white man ultimately telling them what to do. Even, what's-her-face, Fouty. Why did she listen to this man, like, tell her what to do? This obviously racist man that's, like, poisoning black kids with some, like, secret experiments, and you're helping him, like, farm these children and kidnap these children to run experiments on them. Why are you letting this man tell you what to do? It just didn't really make a lot of sense to me, and I feel like that's part of the reason, or the main reason why I felt like it was just, like, a weak, unneeded part of the season.
Yeah, like, I would have understood if they had shown that he was threatening them in some kind of way, but we never got to see any of that.
Yeah. He threatens Tobias Will. he like, Tobias is, like, you know, from that, the sense of, I want to see at the table, so him and, like, the dragon have something common. But, I mean, Fouty, like, and even, like, Lady Eve, I don't get it. Whatever. Continue.
Yeah, it was definitely the weaker part of the season. Or not, like, at the season in the whole, but, like, you know, in terms of the villain story, especially, like, when he was popping in, like, while we didn't know where Tobias was. It was just kind of like, why are we dealing with this other storyline that we don't care about? This is not, I don't understand. Plus, it came from, like, Gamby's backstory, which we were already, like, nobody really cares about your backstory, Gamby. So it was not a great start for them. And yeah, like, having them be, like, this, like, one-dimensional, like, heavy-handed, like, picture of racism is kind of, you know, like, we've already seen enough depictions of that. So, and also have that in office. But the one thing about the plotline, like you said, like, we don't know why people are following them, because we don't see what anyone is gaining from what he is doing, you know? Like, if you're showing a storyline where people would go against their self-interest or would go against their community in order to gain something, then you have, like, some kind of nuanced perspective on it. Like, we're seeing, like, what it is, why it is that they're doing this. But without that, like, I don't know why Tobias wouldn't just, you know, kill him and be like, well, this is my town and I'm going to deal with it how I want to. Instead of, like, oh, yes, I want these green light monster people that may or may not go my way. Like, the one that we have right now, like, green light person that's, like, I guess it's green light person's on their side is, I've literally forgot her name, but I love him. Khalil, is that his name?
Yeah.
Okay, yes, my son. My son, Khalil.
Is he your son again?
Yeah, well, I mean, the actor is my son, but I can't remember his name. That's why.
Jordan Calloway or somebody.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, Jordan Calloway, yeah. But anyway, he's great. But, like, we don't, like, they don't know what he's gonna do, right? Like, he's on their side right now, but, like, at any moment, Jennifer could be like, I just, please, and then he'd go on the other side, you know? So, like, I don't know. You're not getting anything out of it.
So is he the wild card?
Oh, hey, no, he's not a wild card. I'm just saying that, like, that's the only example they have of what works for them, like the ASA, right? Like, this is, like, the only interesting thing about them is all the kids with the green light, is what I'm saying. So the only one we've seen is Khalil.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the thing, you know.
No, Khalil's not a green light kid. He just has, like, a metal super rod. Oh,
so yeah, because he got that. Yeah, he doesn't
have green light. All right, well, then, whatever.
Yeah,
he owes Tobias. So I'm just saying, like, the only thing that's of interesting to them is the green light kids, and we don't know where that's going to go, so.
Yeah.
And I would classify Khalil, a.k.a. Painkiller, as an underdog right now. Okay. Because
yes,
we haven't really seen what he's capable of. And is this new Khalil, like, the actual Khalil? Or is he going to, like, stop being an asshole anytime soon?
Yeah.
So.
Yes, I'm worried Jennifer might just take him back and then I'll be upset. But anyway.
She won't take him back. She loves herself.
No, I completely agree about the ASA. I think, even in general, they were just kind of boring to watch. Like, no one cared, and they just came in, and there was only 13 episodes, and there was a lot going on, and we didn't need something extra to be added on to all of that stuff. Like, I think if they wanted to, they could have introduced them in the second season, and maybe it could have worked. But with Lady Eve and then Tobias and all this other stuff going on, we didn't need them and lurking in the background. It's like, really, the white man is pulling all the strings, you know? Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
It just fell flat, so. Sorry, Gambi.
That kind of wraps up our very in-depth discussion on all the villains that are, well, not all the villains, but the ones we care to talk about. So if you have any kind of thoughts or, you know, want to tell us who your favorite villains were or who you thought was the floppiest flop to flop of all time, you know, let us know. You can hit us up on Twitter at DCTVGumption. You can send us an email, ladieswgumption@gmail.com, or you can send us an ask on Tumblr, ladieswgumption.tumblr.com. Let us know what you think, and we'll be back next week. And next week is episode 52. Yes. So DC Comics, DC 52. So we'll have to do something special for that.
Yes.
Yay. And then after that, it's almost showtime, baby. All of our shows. Mm-hmm. So we'll do something, I guess, like a recap to get you guys up to speed and what we'll be excited for when the shows come back. So stick around. But not like right now. Just like,
wait here. Don't go anywhere.
Don't go anywhere for one whole week. All right, guys. Bye.
Bye.